freedom. The greatest thing about this country, whether you agree with me or not, it's the absolute truth. If you take this away from any person or any group of people, you have no country. Freedom. You have no religion. You have no sound money. You don't have any of it. You're subject to the control of the people who have taken your freedom away and who are now subjecting you to their will, because that's what lack of freedom is. Being subject. You know what subject means? To someone else's will. Freedom means you're subject to your own will. As long as what? As long as you take responsibility for your actions, and you never hurt the person or property of any other human being.
It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show. Yes, still hoofed off the FM airwaves, but here we are on the People's Republic Stokescroft web stream, live web stream. If you'd like to see us back on Bristol Community Radio, you can just go to our website at thisweek.org.uk. Go to the contact page and you can contact directly the chairman of the BCFM board and also the managing editor, Pat Hart, and let him know what you think. Should we be back on the airwaves or not? Anyway, it's Friday, 5 o'clock, and I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is author of 9/11 Revealed, Ian Henshaw, and Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. The Charlie Hebdo terror trials this week. So why has it taken 5 years for the French authorities to get their story straight and bring those arrested to court? 5 years, yes. And as Russian dissident Alexei Navalny lies sick in a Berlin hospital, apparently poisoned with Novichok, we ask, what is US spy Vil Saltonovich Miryazov? What is his role in the decades-long Novichok story? Is it actually as dangerous, this stuff, as we've been told? And what about Alexander Litvinenko? Remember him? Who's also supposed to have been poisoned by Putin back in 2006. Only his brother, his sister, and his father don't think he was. And the British inquest only said he probably was. Did he ever really work as a spy, Litvinenko, or was he just a former policeman trying to sell protection to gullible Western visitors to the newly opened up Russia? And more to the point, trying to blackmail criminal oligarchs in London? That could have gotten him killed by them, indeed. And next week, it's the anniversary of the 2001 9/11 attacks, with the official story in pieces and evidence pointing to the Israeli Secret Service in conjunction with traitors within the US government and military being behind the attacks. We get the views of former psychological warfare officer Scott Bennett, airline pilot and author of The Big Bamboozle, Philip Marshall, who died in suspicious circumstances, producer of the In Plain Sight video, Dave von Kleist, and we also hear the testimony of National Security Advisor on the day, Richard Clarke, all under the expert eye of author of 9/11, The New Evidence, who's joining us here in the studio, and a medieval satanic group infiltrating all the monotheistic faiths, hell-bent on privatising the earth so they can buy it up for their own private property, an English king that stood in their way and had his head removed for his trouble. Author of The Dying God, we heard last week from David Livingstone giving his view on the origins of the Jewish Kabbalah. One of the world's best scholars and authors on the topic, I think, author of Transhumanism, The History of a Dangerous Idea. David Livingstone this week on the Rosicrucians and the role of Francis Bacon and John Dee in paving the way for the militant atheist establishment behind the British Empire. But you know, joining me to review this week's news is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and also author of 9/11 Revealed, Ian Henshaw. Welcome to the programme, both of you.
Hello.
To start with this week, Martin, I think we should ask you about what you make of the resignation of a chap called Paul Smith. He's a Labour Party member. He's on Bristol City Council here as the Cabinet Member for Housing. By resigning, he has potentially put the City Council in quite a lot of trouble, leaving on the committees at the very least, the Labour Party without a majority potentially.
Well, I don't really know what his reasons are, and no doubt we're going to hear, because I believe you've done an interview with him. If he hasn't resigned as a councillor, then it won't obviously change the committees. If he's resigned as a councillor as well as being in the cabinet, then it will. And since I don't know which is which, it's hard to comment.
Actually, I know you're from the South Coast, Ian. Yeah. You've had a similar sort of thing going on in Brighton. I wonder if you've been following that, where various people have been... Actually, in this case, he's resigned, but you've had Labour Brighton councillors expelled from the party, leaving the Greens in charge of Brighton.
Yeah, the Greens are back in charge in Brighton due to self-mutilation by the Labour Party. It seems that the... purge, you know, the witch hunt against anybody who doesn't agree with 105% of the Israeli government's opinions is still no longer welcome in the new Labour Party.
Martin,
even if it means losing a council.
Amazing, isn't it? I mean, it doesn't look as if they're going to lose Bristol, Martin, but it certainly isn't the most intelligent thing for the party to be doing, to be getting rid of members for anti-Semitism or any other reason, if it means they're going to lose the cutting off the nose to spite their face.
Well, I believe Harriet, second name I've forgotten, was...
Harriet Bradley.
Yeah, she was suspended at one stage for supposed anti-Semitism, but she's still in the party. I think she's just suspended.
I understand she's still suspended, actually, and so that's one of the reasons why this is so difficult, because she's not actually officially a party member. You know, it's meant that that Paul Smith going too, as he hasn't actually resigned yet, but anyway, it's put quite a lot of pressure on the Labour Party in the city. They're only just hanging on by their fingernails now.
Well, they're hanging on by their fingernails in the sense that they won't have a majority over all the other parties anymore, potentially. But don't forget that Marvin is still the mayor, and under the Tory rules, the mayor decides everything anyway.
So what's the point of electing councillors when the mayor's deciding everything?
Well, that's a good question. I don't believe in the mayoral system, but then there we are. The Tories and the Liberal Democrats decided it was a good idea.
Okay,
and that's why we've got it.
As I understand it, the rules are different. The Local Government Association have information on the legal position of local authorities between council committees and full council. So when full council meets, Marvin Rees gets an extra vote, who's the mayor, as well as all the councillors, and also Jos Clark, who is the Lord Mayor or Mayoress, she doesn't get a vote. So by that means, by your extra Marvin Rees vote and one less Liberal Democrat vote because of the Lord Mayor, at full council, it looks as if the Labour Party will still have a pretty two-seat majority, but it's on the committees that it's going to change. But anyway, let's have a listen now to the Labour councillor Paul Smith, who I spoke to yesterday about this. I mean, he basically, although he says he's retiring, I asked him, well, this is really a resignation, not a retirement, Paul.
I'm Paul Smith, Cabinet Member for Housing at Bristol City Council. And there are 13,000 households on the council's waiting list. There are 600 families in temporary accommodation, 280 homeless people in hotels at the moment, and also house prices average 10 times earnings. So housing is a huge issue in this city in many ways. Also, one in six of Bristol citizens live in council housing.
A lot of people will be looking at this and saying, well, actually, you've ditched your responsibilities by resigning. You say you're retiring, but actually that's not really the right word, is it? You're well below retirement age and you're taking up another job.
I'm leaving the council to take on another role. I first retired from the council when I was 34, so I don't think it's an age issue, really. I mean, it's anybody who's in a role, something else comes along, and then they move over to it. And I think that it's fairly normal.
But some people will look at it and say, well, you, Paul, have done all you can at the city council. There's no more you can do. And that's one of the reasons that people leave jobs of responsibility like you've got, is because they don't feel they can achieve any more in that role.
Or they feel they can achieve more in another role. So in terms of my role at the council, I feel that I have achieved quite a lot and actually made many of the changes that I wanted to make in terms of the culture of the housing department, the significance of the housing department within the council. Got a new director in who's now driving forward on that agenda. In terms of housing delivery, we've got the council through its council housing and its company, Gorham Homes, has got a pipeline of over 2,000 homes that it's building, meaning that the council will be the largest developer, residential developer within the
city. But hang on, these pipelines actually largely consist of just land with no housing on it, and you could be accused of land banking.
I think that that's completely unreasonable. There, we have to go through the planning process the same as anybody else. As soon as we get through planning, we start on site. I mean, we've been, I think, tremendous at actually getting sites built out very quickly, particularly, say, compared to both the private sector and the housing associations.
Can you point to one or two sites in the city that you think are kind of jewel in the crown that you would say is a good job that you've done whilst you've been doing housing here?
Yeah, there's the what was the elderly person's home at Broom Hill, which we've demolished. There's now 13 homes there with people living in them. Just down the road from there, there's another 5 bungalows that we've built. Ashton Rise, which is our first estate, if you like, of 133 homes. There are now people living there. It's still being built out, but there's absolutely no land banking. There's a couple of sites in Henbury, which between them have over 50 homes with people living in them. We can point to quite a large number, actually, of sites that we've developed, and we've moved very quickly on.
People in the Cabinet, in the Labour Party, and particularly the Mayor, Marvin Rees, will not be happy about what you've done. You've rather dropped them in it, leaving them with great doubts about whether they've actually got a majority and that they can control the city anymore now.
I don't think that's true at all. In terms of the full council meeting, the Labour Party still has a majority of 2 votes on the council. And as they always used to say, one is enough. So I don't think there's any credibility to that accusation.
But once you've left, Paul, there won't be a majority, will there?
Once I've left, there'll be a majority of 2 in the council. The Bristol Post have reported claims by Councillor Tim Kent saying at the full council meetings there's an equality of votes, which there isn't, because there are 34 Labour councillors plus the Mayor has a vote as well. So that gives Labour 35 votes. The other parties have 34 councillors, but one of those is the Lord Mayor and therefore doesn't vote, which means the other parties have 33 votes. So 35 to 33 is a majority.
But you've left them on a cliff edge, Paul. You shouldn't be pulling out. You've let the party down.
I don't think I've done that at all.
Well, many lay people were thinking, actually, at the moment, we could do without this resignation. And you, a bit selfish, this is just a career move for you. Actually, it's left the lay people wondering whether they can hang on to control of the city.
Well, funny that nobody from the Labour Party has said that to me. And I've had communications from over 100 Labour Party members congratulating me. So I don't know where you get your information from, but I don't think it's at all true. And as I say, Labour has a 2-vote majority in the council meetings.
Can you tell us about this job you're moving to and how it compares to your old job?
It's actually a paid employment. It's a job rather than being a politician. And it was never my intention to hang around the
council.
Well,
hang on, you get paid as a politician.
Yeah, we get an allowance as a politician, but I haven't got an employment contract. The current role I have as a politician is that I can advise on policy. I can advise officers in terms of the way I want them to take the housing service. I can't instruct. I don't manage anybody, whereas I move into a role where I'm chief executive of a housing organisation where I have executive responsibility for managing an organisation. So they are quite different in their function. The organisation that I'm moving to is called Elim Housing. They currently own and manage 800 homes from Birmingham to Devon and into Newport, but with a sort of concentration of housing in Bristol and South Gloucestershire. They provide standard housing, also supported housing for homeless people, housing for homeless single parents. They manage traveller sites across the southwest of England. So they provide a wide range of different housing services. they're not at the moment a very large developer. It's quite difficult for small associations to compete with the larger ones, but they've got a small but steady development program at the moment.
But surely, you know, as part of the council and the Labour Party, you could do something about policy. You could change the direction of the ship. All you can do working for a housing association is actually build the houses. You can't actually improve the whole situation, Paul.
Well, I think it's wrong to think that housing associations only exist to build houses. If you take Elim Housing, where I'm going, they manage 800 homes. They house over 1,000 people. I would say you start with the quality of service to the people who already live in your homes rather than focusing on what you can build. I mean, I've worked in the housing association sector for over 30 years. And so, in a sense, coming onto the council was an interruption of that work. I never intended to stay on the council for more than two terms. We've had this term extended because of COVID. An opportunity has come up within the city, which, I mean, this particular role, the last time it came up was 30 years ago. So these opportunities don't come very often. And I've taken the decision to take advantage of that opportunity.
What about the travellers? Because there's a lot of people wondering why the council is pursuing an injunction at the moment against travellers in St Werburgh's.
My understanding is that the injunction that's been served in a part of St Werburgh's is van dwellers rather than travellers. And you'll know that there's quite strict legal definitions of gypsy, Romany travellers as opposed to people who live in vehicles. The reason that the council is taking an injunction for that area of St Werburgh's is the level of antisocial behaviour which has been reported by residents in that area. So in some respects, it's very similar to the action that was taken in Greenbank. We've also offered people alternative places to pitch their vehicles. So they're not being criminalised. They're just being asked to vacate a particular area of road space.
I mean, the travellers themselves will say that the sites they're being offered are way too far out of town. And you know, if they're cycling into work every day, you know, it's an impossible place to put them.
As I say, I mean, you keep using the phrase travellers. I don't believe that they are travellers. I believe that they're people who live in vans. So the sites that we're offering are further out from the centre of the city. But of course, there are lots of places where people can park a vehicle closer to the centre of the city. And in many places, people are living in vehicles. There are no problems particularly caused by that, and it operates fine in a fine balance between those people and the residents who live in houses and flats.
It seems a bit unfair to do this to the travellers on the 1 year during the pandemic when none of them are away at festivals as they would normally be.
Well, firstly, most of the festivals are finished by now. I don't really understand the point. The issue is not about stopping people living in vehicles or parking up on parts of the city. It's about the level of antisocial behaviour that's been caused, which has disrupted the lives of people living in that area.
Well, why is it that the Bristol City Council is employing this barrister and paying for them out of the waste budget rather than the housing budget? Surely these are people that need housing rather than fly-tipped rubbish.
So I don't know about the employment of the barrister or where the enforcement arm of the council comes not under the housing department. It comes under neighbourhood enforcement. So I presume it's funded through the council tax. It's not the enforcement function is not a housing function. So I think you'd have to address that question to Councillor Steve Pearce, who's responsible for enforcement rather than me.
What's your legacy going to be, do you think, Paul, doing housing in the city? Because I think quite a few people have said that at least the council is now building council houses again.
I would like to hope that there are several legacies. I think one is the re-emergence of council housing within the city, which is not just about us building more, although that's really important. It's also about us improving the service that council tenants get, which there's a large piece of work on making that service much more responsive to local people and to our tenants. But also we've got plans to work with tenants on some of our existing low quality estates to rebuild them, so that we will have a major new generation of council housing across the city. That's one. I think the other one would be the massive growth of community-led housing within the city. We've worked with the community-led housing sector, and across the city, they've got plans to build 1,000 homes. One of the biggest schemes in South Mead has just received planning permission. There are other applications in for sites across the city, and people taking control of their own housing issues through community-led housing. I think Bristol is seen as being at the forefront of that, and I'm sure that will continue, because whilst I've helped facilitate it there, it's not down to me, it's down to scores of people across the city who are really passionate about meeting their local housing needs themselves.
Okay, Councillor Paul Smith, at the moment still just about housing position on the Cabinet. Thanks very much for joining us.
Okay, thanks, Tony. You take care.
So that's Paul Smith there, Martin. I mean, you've got to think to yourself, well, maybe he just feels that maybe he just feels that he's done all he can now, and that the next year would be a waste of time doing housing in the City Cabinet. He's much better to go out and become a chief executive of a housing association, where he's got actually a little bit more control himself, rather than having the mayor staring over his shoulder the whole time.
Well, not necessarily about the mayor staring over his shoulder. Basically, he made the case there that he's basically done the job. He wouldn't, I mean, if there'd been an election in May, that would have been, you know, he might have been re-elected, but he's decided he's going to move on. And, you know, that's up to him, isn't it, really?
Certainly is. Okay, so let's talk now a bit about COVID. I mean, this is the story which sort of has taken the whole world over, really, hasn't it? The world's gone mad. I sometimes look at it and think, what's happened here?
We're all experts on viruses now, aren't we?
Supposedly, yeah. I found quite interesting to see at the massive march that there was, rally effectively in Trafalgar Square last Saturday. I was listening intently to Radio 4, listening through at 5 o'clock, where they talked about a march in Berlin on the 5 o'clock news bulletin on the BBC network Radio 4, where they were saying there were 18,000. The later reports, or certainly reports from Germany, were saying it was more like 50,000-60,000. And they didn't mention the Trafalgar Square march at all. So before we actually go to Trafalgar Square and hear a little bit from there, I'd just like to get comments from both of you on how the BBC can be commenting on a march in Berlin, where there's actually almost as big a march in Trafalgar Square that doesn't even get a mention on the news, Martin.
Well, I didn't follow any of the news reports about it, apart from on the internet, just with half an eye. So, what the BBC did or didn't do, I can't really comment on, because I don't know what they said.
Well, I just told you they didn't report on it at all at 5 o'clock.
Well, I mean, but I definitely saw about it myself. But I'm generally an internet news person. I don't generally follow.
Isn't there a certain aspect to this where they don't actually want to see it, Ian?
Well, I think they you can bury things. The BBC is such a huge organisation that they carry surprising stories, surprisingly interesting stories that we'd be, you know, I'm going to mention some later if you'd like me to. So, you know, I wouldn't necessarily infer that they didn't mention it anywhere. You'll probably find some little, maybe the local Trafalgar Square, you know, area broadcast.
Maybe Newsroom Southeast did, you know, which covers the region. It's a region part of the world.
The fact was, this was an interesting national demonstration which should have had wide coverage on the BBC, but apparently didn't.
Maybe they were getting their story straight. Who knows? Of course, this is civil servants. It does tend to be quite bureaucratic. I mean, when I worked there, sometimes, particularly when there was a war starting, everyone would be very, very cautious about. We must check this with the editor. Must check this with the editor. And there wasn't a lot of letting journalists off the leash. Or producers. But anyway, let's have a listen now to Anna Breeze. She's a former BBC journalist, and she was down at Trafalgar Square last Saturday.
So why have you come today? because of all the corruption. I cannot understand how people cannot see that it's a load of rubbish. I'd like, staying indoors lowers your immune system drastically. Staying away from people lowers your immune system drastically. Wearing a muzzle does the same thing. How can we possibly listen to our government? How can you listen to them? And you've got to use your own common sense. People are just following blindly what other people are doing and what the government is saying, and you cannot do that anymore. Not in this.
Where have you come from, and what do you do?
Denbighdale.
We've all got a phone. We report the news for ourselves so we can see the lies when the mainstream media throws the propaganda at us. The mainstream news has an obligation to find the truth, to truth, and report on the truth, and they don't do that. So I'm here today to just try and bring some light onto the fact that the human trafficking thing's a problem. You know, slavery, they've created Black Lives Matter to do with slavery, while the mainstream media are hiding the real fact that slavery still exists. The people are still being sold, you know, the children are being sold, undocumented, and that's a form of slavery in my eyes.
We've come up from Worthing today and all over West Sussex. And we're here because we want to make our voices heard, because we can see very clearly that this COVID-19 so-called plandemic is actually being used as a pretext for introducing the New World Order. That might sound crazy, but when you look at the way our human rights have been stripped from us, it's not so hard to see.
Our life, our family, our decision. So why have you come along?
Well, basically, everything we know, all of our freedoms, has just been taken away. I've got a little girl. I don't wish to have her poisoned by a psychopath. The government are completely lying to us about everything. It's like they're just playing the public. They're just playing us.
What's the solution?
For everyone to wake up, basically.
I quite like that last one. I don't want my child to be poisoned by a psychopath. In a lot of the coverage of this, Martin, we had the major national newspapers saying that the whole thing was led by lunatics. There was this sort of idea that, well, this is a loony demonstration. Do you think that's fair?
Well, there's going to be different views about this. I mean, there are several different views being presented there by the people participating. So, and of course, you know, I believe Piers Corbyn was on Good Morning Britain and got a monstering from Piers Morgan and various others.
You say he got a monstering. Okay, so, I mean, we haven't got a clip of that on here tonight, but he was abused after he'd been on air. So they didn't call him a lunatic and say he was mad to his face. They waited until he was off air, and then they said it whilst he wasn't able to reply.
Yeah, well, I think that tends to suggest that everybody's getting way too involved in this. You know, there are going to be different views about this. Of course there are. And that's inevitable. And, of course, you can scream and shout at people, whatever your views, but that's not necessarily going to get us anywhere,
is it? There is a huge range of view. I've never known a topic where there's been such a wide range, from psychopaths poisoning our children to, you know, we must, you know, to avoid the mass extermination, we must all have a vaccine within 3 months. You know, it's just extraordinary.
It certainly is. And that debate, of course, we need effective journalism, we need balanced journalism, and we need interrogative journalism in order to have that public discussion. Anyway, so one of the speakers, I mean, there were all sorts, but my personal favourite is Professor Dolores Cahill, who's an epidemiologist an Irish epidemiologist. She's worked all over the world, really at the top of her field, but she has really stepped aside from her main job, and she has become a very vehement campaigner, particularly around what she believes is bad science and bad medicine, which is being peddled in the mainstream press for truth. So let's have a listen to a part of her speech last Saturday in Trafalgar Square.
This is not 100% of the annual flu death. It's not 70%. It's not 50%. The annual flu deaths are 400,000. It's not 40%. It's not 10%. It's not 5%. It's 1%. We had 1% of chance of dying of the normal flu season. There was no need to call a pandemic. It's an absolute crime. Yeah! 1%. That means they knew that there was no danger. And as Dr. Vernon Coleman has said, were from the lockdown. The deaths were from the care homes. The deaths were from the medical profession that did not give our loved ones the proper treatment. We need to change this. We are the change. We are the change. We are the change. We are the change. The second bit of good news is that there are wonderful treatments. So if you get a flu, you'll have the symptoms for a week. And there are wonderful treatments like hydroxychloroquine. Yes, that works in 3 hours. So if you have flu, hydroxychloroquine will work. You won't get symptoms, so our elderly will not be sick. And you know, with the disease, you have to have symptoms. So they are diagnosing a disease with no symptoms. And I have a world-renowned fact. If you have no symptoms, you don't need to go to hospital. If you have no symptoms and you don't need to go to hospital, you're not going to die. So stop testing. Stop testing. Stop testing. Stop testing. Stop testing. Stop testing.
And that contrasts with Jacinda over in New Zealand, Martin. Her mantra is test. I've got to get the accent right. Test, test, test. And now there's Dolores Cahill saying stop testing. What she's saying effectively is that the tests are bringing up not only false positives, but they're testing now for a strain of COVID, which is nowhere near as dangerous as the original strain was, which is counterproductive. It's causing lockdowns where people aren't actually even ill.
Well, I'm agnostic about all of this. That was a very emotional speech. That's what I'd say. And, I'll bet you though that in New Zealand the majority are going to return Jacinda in the election on September the 18th because they think she's done a good job, and most of them will never have heard of Dolores Cahill.
Ian, what do you make of the demonstration and particularly what Dolores has had to say?
Well, I found myself in a rather odd position here, Tony, because I've got it in three different ways. Our neighbour in Hove was the super spreader who kicked it all off in January, and I was on TV news saying how his symptoms were minimal. So that puts me down as a sceptic, I suppose.
Well, just tell us about this, because this was right at the very beginning, back in March, was
yeah.
it?
No, soon. February, yeah.
February,
yeah.
Wow. Take us through that story then.
Well, to cut a long story short, we got up one morning and there was a load of people milling around outside the house. We're a quiet suburban street,
this
by the way.
This is in Brighton, is it?
In Hove.
In Hove.
Hove, please.
Sorry.
And it turned out that our neighbour, unbeknown to us, was in intensive care. Not intensive care, in quarantine. You know, what do they call it? Anyway, in hospital with this terrible new virus, which was destined to kill lots and lots of people. And I spoke to them, you know, on the phone, and they said, this is a load of rubbish.
So at this time, just to sort of think back, we had the outbreak had started already in Wuhan, and it was being set. We're seeing on the news things like pictures of people actually lying in the street. It looks as if they passed out in the street, that sort of thing. But it hadn't reached this part of the world at all at that point.
No, it hadn't. No.
Apparently.
Yeah.
But it reached Hove.
But it reached Hove. Well, this was one of the first people that the record shows, the official record shows, brought it in. And I just went on, I said to the media outside, you know, because we were getting a bit fed up with them by then. They'd been there for a few days. I said, look, I've just spoken to them and it's a complete non-story. It's a rubbish story. And that phrase went all over the networks. It was on the main news on TV. So I feel a bit sort of committed now. And when they started saying, well, there's 1,000 people dying a day, you know, I thought, well, blimey, you know, maybe I'm partly responsible for not raising the alarm about this. But then we found out that most of those 1,000 people are actually dying of other things and in care homes. My take on it is that there is something there. And because they've run down the National Health Service so badly, they panicked. And that's why they emptied the hospitals and filled up the care homes and indirectly killed all the people like that, was because they knew that the NHS couldn't cope with the slightest problem. Compare, for instance, Germany, where they've had a very, very low death rate. Nobody will tell you this on BBC, or if they do, it'll be well buried. But, of course, the big difference between here and Germany is that in Germany, they've got spare capacity in the health service, like any sensible person running any organisation knows, you've got to have spare capacity for the unforeseen things. And they knew they didn't have it. It was far too late to create it. So they went into panic mode and made what could have been a minor epidemic into a huge global story, basically.
Well, one of the things that was coming out at the protests on Saturday in London was this whole idea that the virus has not been proven to exist. Now, I would take issue with that. Martin, we know, don't we, that there's potential here, quite a strong potential for this to be actually a bioweapon, a man-made COVID-19. And so, obviously, if it is, then the government will not be wishing to put the genome and all the details of it all around and about here, there and everywhere. So I wonder if people like Piers Corbyn aren't barking up the wrong tree saying, oh, well, you haven't proved us by showing this genome of this thing. Maybe it's just simply because, actually, if they did, it might be some fingerprints all over that genome showing that it is a military weapon rather than just an ordinary coronavirus, the common cold.
I thought the Chinese produced genome.
The British government haven't, though. That's the point they were making in Trafalgar Square. Right. Anyway, Martin.
Well, one of the first things that crossed my mind, that it was some kind of a bioweapon, and of course you've got Steve Bannon, who's now under arrest in the US, and the Murdoch press definitely pushing the idea that it was a bioweapon developed by the Chinese, which had escaped from the Wuhan laboratory. And spokespeople for the Chinese government then responded by pointing out that the Wuhan games, military games, had taken place just at the time when this was all beginning, and that allowed a vector for NATO intelligence services to bring in a bioweapon. We know that they used anthrax from Fort Detrick in the subsequent to 9/11. That definitely led back to the US.
And well, that was used, basically, wasn't it? It was sent to senators and media.
In integral part of the 9/11 operation.
Yes, that's right. So we know that they do use this kind of thing. And, of course, the Chinese intelligence services probably know that too.
So who are they? Who is posting these letters?
Well, it'll be the deep state in the US, won't it? Whatever the deep state is. We can even name names if we've got enough information to name names. They were all involved, you know, they've been developing these biological and chemical weapons for years. In theory, they're not supposed to be doing it. As Craig Murray pointed out, the Russian biological and chemical warfare laboratories, which were located in Uzbekistan, were dismantled at the time he was a British ambassador there. And, of course, they fulfilled their... And, of course, Assad got rid of all the chemical weapons that he had in Syria under the supervision of the OCPCW.
Yeah, but the Chinese have said the Wuhan lab was a civilian lab. The only problem is there was Pentagon money in
there. That's right.
So that does sound a bit weird. Well, what's Pentagon money doing in a Chinese civil laboratory for viruses?
What's going on is, because of MERS and SARS in the past, there is definitely, I would argue, a legitimate fear that pandemics will develop either naturally or possibly, as we're discussing, as a result of manipulation. And one of the things that these laboratories do, I understand, is that they get relatively harmless viruses and weaponize them so that they can deal with a weaponized virus or a mutated virus because they've already
I have to blink and sort of pinch myself. Are you saying that they're developing these deadly viruses that could spread and kill millions of people just in order to sort of use them as a kind of a test to see what would happen if someone was crazy enough to invent that virus?
Or by running through mutating the virus, you can see how it might mutate in the wild. This is the sort of justification, and therefore you've already worked out what might happen, and you've got virus. You've developed things to block it. Now, in actual fact,
sounds like quite a dangerous.
Well, it is. It is indeed, and of course, in actual fact, there are laws again. You know, in theory, the international conventions are all of these things should be stopped. Now, in actual fact, the US, like in many other things, is not signed up to these international... They signed the convention, but they refused to ratify it, which is why Fort Detrick and Porton Down are still there. I mean, basically, they should be abolished. But they've not been abolished because we haven't abolished them.
Anyway, back to Saturday in the demo in London, and arrested was Piers Corbyn, who's the brother of the former Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn, who was one of the organisers, allegedly. I have to say that because he's now apparently been fined £10,000. But anyway, you mentioned that he was on the Piers Morgan show, and here he is on the Richie Allen show talking about his appearance on the Piers Morgan programme, and it starts with Richie Allen here.
Morgan and Susanna Reid are of a certain age. They remember when it used to be done properly. And when you were dropping a couple of truth bombs on them and giving them some truth about hydroxychloroquine or whatever it is, they're burning burning with shame that they're not doing it. Couldn't call it.
It's a fact, and they just said that's not true. Well, they were lying directly on the TV. And they committed, slander against me, calling me a nutter, when I was off air, but they were still there. I mean, I wonder if Piers Morgan has even got O-level physics. I don't know. But, you know, he's clearly, if he has knowledge, he doesn't like using it. He just wants to shout at people, which is completely out of order. But I think, Richie, this is a sign of the times because, you know, that and then our fund being taken down and, of course, my arrest itself. That was very interesting because, you see, in the 2 weeks building up to the Trafalgar Square 35,000 at least rally, the police had been very reasonable. I mean, I've discussed things with them, talked every day, and they asked, well, okay, Mr. Corbyn, what are you really expecting? Have you got any safeguards? Is any trouble, you know, sensible discussions in a normal way. And I said, yes, where do you want to go afterwards? We'll make sure you can march from Trafalgar Square towards Downing Street and so forth. So they were cooperative. Then, at the last minute, when most people had left the square and I was still hanging around talking to people, a different group of police turned up and just pounced on me and put me in a van. And I said, look, guys, what is going on here? Because this isn't anything in that we were expecting.
Yeah.
And the coppers said, indicated in a not very unroundabout way, it came from the top, Mr. Corbyn. So, you know, it was a decision taken somewhere that whatever, because our rally was so successful, and therefore we'd embarrassing them so much, I don't know, that we had to be taken out. And they would have taken out more people, but for the fact that some people realised what was going on and scarpered from the square quickly.
Interesting, that, isn't it? From the top. I wonder whether what they mean by that, those police speaking as they arrested Piers Corbyn in Trafalgar Square. Do they mean Priti Patel, Home Secretary? Do they mean Sadiq Khan, the London Mayor? Or do they mean Cressida Dick, the Chief of the Met? Who's in charge?
Technically, the Met's under the control of the Home Office, I think, isn't it? Or it always used to be.
Yeah, I would imagine it might be Priti Patel.
Yeah.
But this is political arrests, isn't it, this sort of thing? And that's what he's certainly hinting at there. And a lot of the reports have said that this is an extraordinary arrest because there are all sorts of other demonstrations that have happened, some of which have been violent, where these sorts of arrests haven't taken place.
That's right. I mean, I think it's... and, of course, the £10,000 fine has only just been brought in for people who break COVID regulations. It's not like a normal, you know...
But with no court case, no trial, nothing like that?
I'll be interested to see if it does go to court. I think the defence that Piers Corbyn could make is that I've been talking to the police every day for the 2 weeks prior and they said it was all okay. So how can you then fine me £10,000?
It's interesting, they don't seem to have to produce the evidence that he's an organiser. They're just fining him, Ian.
Just for being there.
Bizarre. Anyway, we'll see what happens. That one's obviously going to bumble along. But I suppose in a way more serious is the GoFundMe deleting the fundraising campaign for the lockdown sceptic Piers Corbyn. That's announced, I think it was Wednesday this week. People are seeing bias about which campaigns are still allowed to operate. So he mentioned briefly there that his fund has been closed down. He's put out a GoFundMe campaign to fund his campaign to win his court case or to pay his fine or whatever, Martin. They just shut it down. GoFundMe have said, nope, you're not funding that.
Well, the thing about GoFundMe is ultimately they're a private organisation, like many are, and if they want to close you down, then they can. And I'm not, that's not saying that's right. I'm just saying that's within their power.
Well, I mean, the first thing that I'd note from this is that all the fears of the anti-COVID activists have been apparently, you know, completely substantiated by it. It's exactly what I would have thought could never have happened, that you could be fined £10,000 for turning up at a peaceful demonstration, basically.
Well, actually, apparently the fine is for organising. There are certain demonstrations, it seems, which are okay and some not. Anyway, well, we'll see what happens with this. One of the other people that commented on this or was on talk radio on Monday was Peter Hitchens.
There was a protest on Saturday, and of course at this protest there were all kinds of weirdos, beyond doubt. I mean, yeah. The British Union of Fascist banner, and I think David Icke
was there.
There's a loopy-loo sorts, but I think there were also, as there were a similar one in Berlin, quite a large number of people genuinely perplexed by what's happening to the country. Mm. And a really astonishing thing happened afterwards, which has been very lightly reported in the newspapers today, that Piers Corbyn,
yes,
that's Jeremy Corbyn's brother, who was the organiser, was grabbed by the police at the end of this demonstration. I mean, literally grabbed, and fined £10,000. Under new laws restricting public, yes, gatherings of more than 30 people. It sounds to me like the Greek colonels. Parliament, I don't believe, has published a law allowing someone to be fined £10,000 without trial for organising a demonstration, which was, as far as I know, peaceful.
Yes.
And which were insulted with the police for days beforehand.
Yeah.
So the police said there were 38,000 people in Berlin, but he's saying here, Martin, isn't he, this is implying here that this is a bit of a slippery slope, that basic liberties are being lost. You know, the idea that you need some evidence in order to fine you seems out the window.
Well, as I understand it, the £10,000 for people organising raves, so they've extended it to demos of more than 50 people or whatever.
Yeah, I think it's any kind of gathering more than 50. They're now saying,
well, there's apparently been a cabinet meeting at which 50 people turned up this week, and the Prime Minister, they basically all crammed in for a meeting with him. Is he going to be fined? I think we can separate out here. People have got different views about the COVID crisis. I tend to the view that it's a biological warfare attack on China, but that's just me. But the fining of Piers Corbyn £10,000 for being the evil mastermind behind the demonstration clearly is an infringement of civil liberties.
Well, look, if it's a biological warfare attack on China, why have we had 41,000 people die in Britain?
Because the whole point, as I've said to you before, Tony, if you look at what happens, is in September, the repo market in the US started to collapse, and they started to intervene to bail out the banks again, as in 2008.
So is it backfired?
No, it's not backfired. Let me just get through the... I'll be as brief as I can. In November, we know from the Times of Israel and ABC News that the Israeli Defense Forces, the IDF, were given a heads up by the Defense Intelligence Agency of the United States of America that there was going to be a pandemic coming out of China. Then, of course, things start happening. Now, what I imagine may have happened here, I'm not saying this is what happened, but it's just a speculation, a copper's hunch, if you like. They're trying to take down the Chinese economy. They've had a massive swine fever, which has wiped out half of their swine herd. They then, this is all into this year, and the beginning and the end of last year, they've lost. They then had a flu epidemic and bird flu, which killed off all their chickens. And then this happens. And of course, they treated.
I should say, actually, within the last few weeks, they've also had some outbreak of bubonic plague in China.
Indeed, and don't forget, at the same time, we've got Pompeo saying we're no longer going to tolerate China. And we've got there's this book called The Thucydides Trap, which has been written by a US academic, whose name I've forgotten, which is basically arguing that if we don't get China now, they're going to be in a position where we won't be able to get
them.
So
this is sounding very similar to the Cold War and the missile gap, where the Americans were saying, we're going to have to get the Russians now because they're catching up with their nuclear arsenal.
Yeah, well, it's not just about this is actually to do with the economy. Because, you know, they always were fairly snooty about this. They thought that the Japanese would never defeat
them. Yeah, but the Chinese are building nuclear power stations like they're going out of fashion, aren't they?
Well, it's not just nuclear power, it's things like 5G and Huawei and all the rest of it.
And they're not doing that because they don't have any oil.
The point is about that. That then they would allow it to flow back over themselves. Don't forget, the deep state in the US is not necessarily friendly to Trump, because they need a cover to carry on bailing the banks out. Look at Rishi Sunak here. the Tories, instead of, you know, there is a magic money tree, and they were going to spend 50 billion and they spent 250
yeah, but
billion
the big beneficiaries,
this year alone.
The big beneficiaries have been people like Amazon and Facebook. These seem
yes,
to be,
and also the banks
people.
Who should have collapsed. Because they were collapsing anyway in September.
Okay, well, anyway, Peter Hitchens...
This is what people don't get.
Peter Hitchens went on to talk about the whole idea of an economic recovery, which he was rather poo-pooing.
I saw one paper saying this would destroy the recovery, and I said, what recovery?
Right.
This is after last week, Pret-a-Manger, a sandwich bar, sacked thousands of people, and after, again, returning to my home city, the mini plant in Oxford began to sack people making cars. There is no recovery. There's the absolute opposite of a recovery. But I think the problem is, if these tax rises don't take place, then the other thing will happen, which is there will be no money to run the public services,
right.
Not least the NHS we're supposed to be so concerned about. So absolutely everything that people rely on will be starved of money. And if you say, well, that road hasn't been repaired, or the hospitals are slum, and the lavatories leak, and all the rest of it, people will say, we're sorry. But the cuts, the COVID cuts, which we're going to come up against, the COVID cuts mean we can't afford to fix that. We can't afford to hire the people. We can't afford to keep people employed. And we will live in a society with a much, much lower standard of living because of this. Mm. And the other thing which is going to happen, and if you think you can escape it, maybe if the tax rates are postponed, is that, of course, the inflation, which I think is now absolutely bound to happen because they've pumped quantitative easing into the public purse for the first time. People are getting money in their pockets from the government in the Rishi Sunak schemes. That has launched a huge amount of money into the open market rather than just the bond market or whatever it was before. And inflation will mean that whatever savings you may have, which of course includes the pension which you hope to live on in your later years, will be shriveled to nothing.
Yeah.
And only people who have assets will survive it. And this is another terrible thing, which people just, because I'm afraid economics is not even taught adequately in most of our schools to most people, will take people by horrible surprise when it comes. But it's so visible to anybody who knows what's going on.
Well, that's interesting to hear Peter Hitchens agreeing with you a little bit, Martin, that people don't get taught proper economics.
I think we've got to step in here and tell Peter Hitchens that there is a magic money tree, and he's completely wrong about that. And much as I respect Peter Hitchens on a lot of issues, he's 100% wrong about that.
Well, just explain then.
Well,
he's talking about inflation.
Inflation was something that happened in the 1970s and early 80s, and hasn't really happened anywhere since. And it was dealt with by Thatcherite supply-side economics. Basically, if you've got an economy that's running at capacity, the global economy running at capacity, and then you start throwing extra cash into it, yes, you will get inflation. But that's not where we are. We're in a huge oversupply. The problem is that nobody's got the money to buy all the things that are pouring out of China, America, if Trump gets his way, Europe, everywhere. So that is the problem. And yes, it can be solved by the best thing to do is to print the money, but the best people to give it to are the poor, of course,
Martin,
not the banks.
Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I broadly would agree with that. I think Peter Hitchens has got the wrong, and there's far more deflationary pressure in the system than he imagines. But of course, the real problem is we've got a total disconnect between the stock markets, which are at the highest levels they've ever been, and the actual figures for the real economy, which is about to fall down the drain. Now, that just shows you how completely separate these two things are. What they've done is they've bailed the banks out again, so there's a whole, that will crash at some point, but there's a load of money to be made by that. I mean, as we can see, the hedge fund people are making a packet out of this latest bubble. But at the same time, of course, ordinary people are saving rather than spending because they're worried about their future, which of course drags demand out of the economy. And asset prices are rising, which of course is a problem for ordinary people because it means they can't afford anywhere to live and they can't afford the rent and things like this. And ultimately, this is going to end in tears quite obviously. And but there's no reason to start cutting public expenditure now. In the long run, you may have to try and balance the books, but the way to do that is to take the money off the people who've been making out like bandits. That's the only way to do it, and of course they're going to resist that.
And Sunak is talking, to be fair, he is talking about a wealth tax.
Yes, I mean, Rishi Sunak has floated that to his own party.
And actually,
and of course, it went down like a lead balloon. What are you talking about?
Well, to be fair to Peter Hitchens, he's also saying there's going to have to be a wealth tax.
Well, I mean, that's quite logical. I mean, but the point is that we shouldn't have to worry about that now. The wealth tax will come. I mean, if there was a Labour government, imagine if McDonald was the Chancellor, he would be flagging up, yes, there's going to have to be a wealth tax, especially since you've just made such a lot of money out of this crisis. And you could have one-off profits tax.
But yeah? How ironic that, you know, the Labour right, who've now seemed to be firmly in control of the party again, you know, that they wouldn't dare suggest a wealth tax because they'd fear being labelled as left-wing.
Well, I mean, what's happened with Rishi Sunak is he's been captured by the Treasury and he's come out with some sensible
proposal. Isn't the Treasury really the city, Martin?
No, not entirely.
I think it is.
No, not entirely, Tony. The city isn't in favour of wealth taxes, Tony. The Bank of England, the Treasury, a different thing. I mean, of course, there's a revolving door and so on, but of course, we do have a permanent civil service here, so some people actually spend their whole lives on that side of the fence.
Okay, so at the very least, the city have got their spies in every single corridor in the Treasury, haven't they?
Yes, well,
they know what they're going to do weeks or months before the Treasury do it.
Well, I mean, and of course, in other countries, and even to some extent here, there's a revolving door, so in actual fact, they end up being the same. But I mean, the point is that Sunak suggesting that it would have to be some kind of wealth taxes is welcome. But of course, you saw that this is what the meeting was between the Prime Minister and his back benchers, where they were not socially distanced, they're all crammed in at the back, because he was basically promising them there would be no wealth taxes. So they all left with a sigh of relief to go home and die of COVID.
So those wealth taxes are really not taxing the money that's being made by those investments in the stock exchange, which is being artificially pumped up with all this QE. Okay, so we've learnt, haven't we, that by printing money you don't necessarily cause inflation, and actually that really what we need is something like Richard Murphy and John McDonald's QE for the people.
Yeah.
As you first of all said there, actually, Ian, that this QE money needs to go to the poorer people. Not only do they need it to buy the basic goods, to pay the rent, etc., they will spend it and they'll actually get the economy
moving.
And
if you give money to the rich, they'll spend it on assets and create asset inflation.
Okay, so yeah, the Conservatives are really doing the complete opposite of what needs to happen.
Well, apart from the fact that they did decide that we're about to end furlough in this country next month, but of course in Germany they're going to carry on with their version of it, which they've used before. It's a standard procedure that they use in recessions. That's going to go on indefinitely, and in France they're talking about keeping it going for the next 2 years. But Rishi Sunak has definitely bet his he's bet on the fact that everybody thinks he's great now because he's in favour of wealth taxes. He's given everybody free dinners. And he's basically spent a hell of a lot more money than he said he was going to spend at the beginning of the crisis, all of which is good, but he's now going to turn around and be the punishing parent and take it all away. And, of course, what that will do is it'll put the economy in a tailspin, just about ready to leave the EU with no deal
so
in January.
At least on that one, you and Peter Hitchens are aligned. He says there's not going to be a recovery.
No, there isn't going to be a recovery until we've completely changed the policy. We need a complete change of policies at the top, and we need a policy which is actually geared towards ordinary people's needs and the environment. But
okay,
we're a long way from that.
So, from the London demonstration on Saturday with about 35,000 people, or 30,000 people certainly, with Trafalgar Square crammed, to Bristol with about 250 of us in Castle Park, all socially distanced, very obedient, and some terrific speeches, not by me particularly, but by, I did a little talk, I think it was for about 10-15 minutes at the start, which you can find on YouTube, but Judith Brown turned up and she did what I thought was a fascinating little talk. She's former nurse, she's a PhD doctor, not a medical doctor, but she was making a very, very simple point that for people must look up. I mean, she'd basically done the research herself. If you have a flu jab, you're more likely to die of COVID. So have a think before you have that flu jab. I thought that was a point very well made, and she made it. But the highlight for me was actually not any of the speakers. It was this lady that turned up, not sure what her name is. If you know who she is, do tell me. You can find my contact details at thisweek.org.uk on the contact page there, because I thought she did rather a lovely poem.
I just thought it all was a bit fishy, because we were given all sorts of statistics about corona public health, but nothing about strokes, heart attacks, suicide, any other kind of illness that
was going to be worse because of the lockdown. So I looked into it and I kept on coming across a certain name, Bill Gates. And I've written this, it's a song really, but I'm going to chant it. And it's called Bill Gates is Not the Messiah. Bill Gates is not the Messiah. He's a very naughty boy. And he'll double his wealth now Global Health is his chief executive toy. He poured his tax-free dollars into a high-return vaccine, and he wants to stick just a tiny prick into every human being. Gates is not the Messiah, though he sure can mesmerize with a tax-free gag to a back-free rag and assisted Google AIs. He brings the truth and the good news and fake checks all the rest. With a youthful ball, he'll divide and rule. If you sneeze, you might be blessed. Gates is not the Messiah, though he'll feed the multitude with a GM crop that'll grow then stop till the contract is renewed. The earth will be deweeded of biodiversity, and to get your food, you've got to be tattooed with a biometric ID. Hey! Gates is not the Messiah, though he wants the common good. If we copulate, we'll overpopulate. There'll be unplanned parenthood. So if, in spite of gaming, you might have scored a duck, get your vax passport, thank the Lord, go for. But for Gates' sake, don't go fuck! Gates is not the Messiah, though he has risen aloft. Can a billionaire really that much care if his heart is Microsoft? He went from riches to riches with a talent to invest, from proprietary DOS to the high DevOps in pursuit of his interest. Hey! This is the last verse. How is it so far? Though we are to him as sheep. Satellites will view everything we do, even though we are asleep. I don't believe he's evil. Maybe he means well, but our souls aren't safe. His intentions pave the way to Orwellian hell!
Well, that's a mystery lady that turned up the bandstand in Castle Park here in Bristol about 2:30 on Sunday as part of that, I think it's called Stand Up Bristol demonstration, which she was very kindly invited along to speak at. These sorts of things are happening, Martin, as well as the Black Lives Matter demonstrations going on. We've also got Extinction Rebellion been demonstrating this week, plus I think a smaller group called Antifa. There does seem to be a sort of almost, this is a, you know, take your pick now. There's quite a few movements out there that are kicking back against the establishment or the authorities.
Yeah, there's a lot. I mean, obviously, there's a great deal of discontent from different different angles. Also, of course, there's a great deal of manipulation of that discontent by various forces. Very dangerous times all round. The economy, the world economy is on a knife edge. There is going to be some kind of crash. And when it happens, of course, the resources of the state will have been spent on bailing the banks out. So you're going to have real struggles over resources going forward.
Well, you'll be happy to hear that Vernon Coleman is not doing any more of his, Dr. Vernon Coleman, any more of his YouTube videos, because you don't like the chap. But, I mean, I'm a big fan of him from years ago. Probably from, it was the 1990s I first came across him, when he authored a book called How to Stop Your Doctor Killing You. And actually, it wasn't really aimed at doctors. It was aimed at the pharmaceutical industry. I wonder what you make, Ian, of the pharmaceutical lobby lobby, because it seems to have grown immensely in power. Certainly, you know, certainly since we were youngsters.
Well, it's follow the money, isn't it? You know, I mean, there's something to be said, I think, about the COVID issue, is that there is now a COVID industry, you know, and there's a lot of people are doing quite well out of COVID. You know, not, for instance, the credit card companies. If you spend £2 now in a corner shop or a cafe, they'll want a card, and they're paying a surprising amount if they're a small place that can't do a good deal with the credit card companies. So that's one, you know, people. Obviously, the pharmaceutical industry, and one mustn't jump to conclusions, but it seems very odd that hydrochloroquine is being systematically denigrated as a potential remedy for coronavirus when it happens to be very cheap.
Yes, it's out of patent, isn't it?
Yeah.
This is the point.
Yeah, yeah, and, yeah. It would be a disaster for the pharmaceutical industry.
The thing I find so annoying about this, we've got no mainstream press coverage of this at all, is that the virus was called SARS-CoV-2 when it first was discovered in China. That was the first designation it was given. So it was quite clear. They were saying that this is a SARS type of coronavirus. SARS is well known. It's actually been out there for quite a while. And chloroquine is the prescribed medicine for SARS. So why on earth would various health authorities around the world issue edicts saying we don't want you doctors prescribing chloroquine for this COVID-19?
Well, what about the fake article in The Lancet? I mean, that's absolutely appalling, and it hasn't even been commented on that I've seen. A completely false article appeared in The Lancet, which is one of the planet's leading and very respected. I always respected The Lancet as being truthful. They came up, for instance, with the figures about how many people had been killed in Iraq, which were very embarrassing to the establishment. Well, they produced this article saying, oh, hydrochloroquine is harmless and possibly dangerous, ineffective and possibly dangerous. And instantly, like almost overnight, several tests, screening programs and, you know, trials were abandoned. Within a week, and that's the really extraordinary thing, within a week, The Lancet had withdrawn the article, the alleged authors, some of them had taken their names off it, and it was basically a 100% fraudulent article, which had the effects of almost completely killing hydrochloroquine in the West as being a cure, although, of course, in India, it seems to be playing quite an important part in limiting the pandemic.
I think it seems certainly various studies are saying Well, anything up from 30% of lives have been being saved by use of chloroquine. That's what the figures I've seen. And it seems, you know, maybe this is just simply being suppressed because the agenda here is to come up with a vaccine which is going to be much more expensive and turn the vaccine industry, the big pharmaceutical companies that are producing this, as I think it's Del Bigtree pointed out, that this could go from a $1 billion industry, or I think it's at $500 billion industry, to a $1 trillion industry. So it could actually go up an entire step in how much money is being made out of vaccines. So let's see what happens with that. But our politicians are supposed to be sorting all this sort of thing out. They haven't really been doing much of a good job. I think most of them seem to be bought by the big pharma's lobby, just as they were in many of these wars by the war lobby. So let's have a listen now to Prime Minister's questions. They're back this Wednesday, Keir Starmer and Boris Johnson having a little bit of a spat again.
Keir Starmer.
Prime Minister is just tin-eared and making it up as he goes along. I'm surprised. The Education Secretary stood at that dispatch box yesterday and said and acknowledged that Labour's first priority has been getting children back to school. That's been our first priority. I've said it numerous times in this dispatch box. He knows it very well. He's just playing games. Mr Speaker, and he's fooling nobody. Even his own MPs have run out of patience. The Vice-Chair of the 22 Committee, the MP for Broxbourne, has said, the government says one thing on Monday, changes its mind on Tuesday, something different is presented on Wednesday. That sounds familiar, doesn't it? Another of MPs, who wisely wants to remain anonymous, perhaps in the chamber today, he or she said, I am speaking for you because this is what was said, it's mess after mess, his own MPs, U-turn after U-turn. It's a fundamental issue of competence. God knows what's going on. There's no grip. His own MPs are right, aren't they?
Oh, Mr. Speaker, this is a leader of the opposition who backed remaining in the EU and now is totally silent on the phone, now has performed a U-turn. He backed, and perhaps he still does, Mr. Speaker. This is a leader of the opposition who supported an IRA condoning politician who wanted to get out of NATO and now says absolutely nothing. This is a leader of the opposition who sat on the front bench whilst there was anti-Semitism.
Order! I think there are questions being asked. We do need to try and answer the questions being put to the Prime Minister. It will be helpful to those who are watching to know the answers. Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I think it will be helpful to all those who are watching to know.
Minister, I think I'll make the decisions today. Come on. Prime Minister.
Sorry, Mr. Speaker, if I may say this, I think it will be helpful to all those who are watching to know that this opposition and this leader of the opposition said absolutely nothing to oppose the method of examinations that was proposed, and indeed they opposed the teacher accreditation system that we eventually came up with. Is he now saying that those grades aren't right, or is it just Captain Hindsight leaping on a bandwagon and opposing a policy that he supported 2 weeks ago?
Yes, Starmer.
The problem is he's governing in hindsight. That's why he's making so many mistakes. Mr. Speaker, before I go on, the Prime Minister said something about the IRA, and I want him to take it back. I worked in Northern Ireland for 5 years with the police service of Northern Ireland, bringing peace. I prosecuted the Director of Public Prosecution, serious terrorist, for 5 years, working with the intelligence and security forces and with the police in Northern Ireland. Asked the Prime Minister to have the decency to withdraw that comment.
Well, I would just point out that Boris Johnson wasn't actually talking about Keir Starmer supporting the IRA. He was saying that he supported Jeremy Corbyn, who supported the IRA. So he didn't withdraw the comment. But Martin, it all seems to be getting very personal, doesn't it? When I listen to Prime Minister's questions, I like to hear a few facts, and I like to hear, you know, people being challenged on the facts, not on you know, these sort of almost like schoolboy knockabout stuff. It seems to have gone back to that again.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the problem. I've never been a fan of Prime Minister's questions, for example. Yeah,
but the thing is, with Jeremy Corbyn, he seemed to be concentrating on hitting the Prime Minister with statistics, facts, and an actual, you know, genuine information, whereas this seems to be much more innuendo now.
Well, I mean, he's basically pointing out the fact that the government has U-turned several times over the exams fiasco. It's a perfectly legitimate thing to point out, and of course, Boris Johnson, who wasn't paying much attention, has got to take responsibility for it. He dumped it all on Gavin Williams.
Ian, what do you make of these two opponents, and how well is the opposition doing and the government?
Well, I was just, you know, thinking while you were talking about that, how depressed, it's a little bit depressing that the public don't see. I mean, it was quite obvious that Johnson didn't have an answer. So what he did was he came up with a standard load of smears. He couldn't even remember it accurately. Maybe he is, you know, a lot of people are thinking that maybe he did get quite ill with the COVID and he hasn't really fully recovered. But he certainly couldn't speak very well, I didn't think. And all he could do was to come up with a standard bunch of smears. That's not answering the question. And you'd think that people would think, well, obviously, if he can't say anything any better than that, he's rubbish. But sadly, people seem to join in, you know, if they start a sort of witch hunt and start pointing and screaming about things, then, you know, but some people get taken
in. I wonder, is this an accident that these sorts of people get into these positions, or is it deliberate? Is the whole democratic system being discredited? Because, of course, this benefits the private industry.
I just worry about human nature, you know. I think we tend to rally around, you know, leaders. It's there in our genes. And if we don't recognise this and build it into the legal system to stop it happening, and I've got a project, you know, that would point the way forward, I hope, on that, which I can tell you about later.
Well, say something about it now.
Well, I've just got a sort of trial website called accountabledemocracy.org.uk, and the idea is, how could we get to a sane society from the society we're in without bloodshed and revolution, you know, because that's always the problem. And, you know, I've got a few ideas that I'm developing, which I'm hoping might influence people.
Is that bloodshed and revolution inevitable at the moment, do you think? Some sort of, you know, clash between the populace and the establishment?
Well, I don't know about inevitable, but it's certainly on the cards. And those sort of revolutions don't usually end up very happily either.
Okay, so how can we do something about that? What are you proposing?
We've got to do it through normal legal procedures. The big weakness of the elite is that they're illegal, they're criminal, and it's only by staving off the forces of the law that they survive in position. And so, I mean, one of the reasons why Trump is so hated is because the crowd who pulled off 9/11 in the States, or who seem to have pulled it off, let's say, John Brennan from the CIA, for instance, who was one of the leading anti-Trump campaigners, he was the CIA station chief in Riyadh in Saudi Arabia at the time that the 9/11 plot was being hatched. I think these guys are more vulnerable than people realize to just the forces of law.
Martin, these people are above the law, many of them, aren't they? I mean, certainly the City of London, we've seen that time and again, the LIBOR scandal, Forex scandal, I mean, scandal after scandal, really, they've just, it's just, they smile, they take another bonus, and the whole thing carries on.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, I think that's absolutely right that they are criminal, and that's not just political rhetoric. When we say they are criminal, we mean that they have Interpol files. That's absolutely true. But whether that anything can be done about that, because, of course, the police officers around the world at senior level are well aware of the criminal behaviour at the top. But, of course, there's limits to what they can and can't do.
But aren't they being paid off, those police?
Well, they are. I mean, Sir John Stevens, for example, was made a lord. But basically, he was saying, we're going to have to prosecute Brigadier Gordon Kerr for running the Loyalist Terror Campaign in Northern Ireland. Since we're mentioning Northern Ireland, as the Prime Minister sought to bring it up about who's protecting who. And, of course, he wasn't prosecuted. He's never been prosecuted. The last I heard of him, he was inside something called a joint services group in the green zone in Iraq, being paid by the British taxpayer. But he should have been made to stand trial in this country. And, of course, he should have been convicted and probably sent to prison for 25 years, like many IRA people were. And then he should have been allowed to go free because we've got a deal.
Well, I mean, if the criminal justice system won't arrest these people who you say are criminals, isn't there room for a citizen's arrest if they've got evidence against them?
Well, the IRA said there's room for us to go around to his house and blow his head off.
Ian. That's,
well, I think I'm going to ignore that last comment, Martin.
No, the war was on, and it's now over.
Martin, it's just let Ian speak.
Yeah. What was the question? Sorry, Tony.
Is this about a citizen's arrest? Is this a feasible thing to do?
No,
if you've
got
evidence on people?
I think you've got to capture... The way they do it is they have the man at the top or the woman at the top. And most of the... If you then add on the doctrine of necessity, so that basically what they'll say is, if you could speak to them privately, they'd say, well, the reason we didn't go for this Kerr guy is because it would demoralise all the rest of the army who are busy doing equally horrible things, and so by necessity, and then we might get invaded by the Russians.
Do you think that's right, Martin?
I think that's right. Yeah, but that's the whole point of putting him on trial, is to deter them from doing exactly that.
Yes.
I mean, I look forward to the day when the senior intelligence officers and military in the US who did 9/11 are put on trial.
Well, meanwhile, we've got people like Julian Assange going through a court process, and we've also got contempt of court trial against Craig Murray, who's been supporting him up in Scotland. So it seems as if something's gone very wrong with the criminal justice system and the justice system generally.
Well, Scotland, you know, I'm sorry to say, much as I think, you know, in many ways it would be quite good if Scotland were to detach itself from England, corruption is not going to benefit. You know, I mean, Scotland, the Scottish Labour Party is, you know, a notoriously corrupt institution.
Nearly dead.
Nearly dead as a result. So there is some justice in the world. But, you know, we had a case with the 9/11 truce movement of somebody who died suspiciously in Scotland, and we found a solicitor who wanted to prosecute it, and suddenly the word came back, no, forget it, go away. You know, obviously nobbled, unfortunately. Yeah. So I think you've got to get... It's only when somebody... But it has happened. I mean, for instance, Gorbachev in the Soviet Union, he quietly rose to the top, kept his powder dry, and then once he did have that absolute power, which modern leaders do tend to have, he used it. Now, the results were unfortunate and didn't work out that well. But, you know, you can dismantle these police states, but you've got to be at the top.
All you need is a bit of help from the Trilateral Commission, David Rockefeller Foundation, and then then you can be Gorbachev. Or actually, isn't it Starmer is a trilateral guy?
Well, he is. Yes, Gorbachev didn't prosecute anybody from the past.
No,
he changed the system.
He changed the system,
and the history will be very kind to him. I think he was very naive about who he was dealing with. His
we don't hear a lot from him now, Martin, do we?
Well, he's still alive.
He's around.
And in actual fact, he's supporting the Russian government on most issues these days. And of course, I look forward. I'm of a generation that I'd like to see Jimmy Carter and Gorbachev commenting on current affairs.
Well,
BBC. Because they were decent guys.
I'm afraid the BBC won't really be doing that. And they came up at Prime Minister's Questions this week. Unfortunately, they're just not interested in these issues. They seem to be bogged down somehow. But anyway, and what it's doing is... I'm reminded a little bit about British Rail. British Rail, before it was privatised, we went into a sort of 3 or 4 or 5 year sort of spiral of it finding really difficult to actually get trains. The ticket offices weren't properly staffed. The trains often didn't turn up. The BBC seems to be in this pre-privatisation mode at the moment.
Well, the new guy's just come in. He's saying that we're going to have a more Brexit-friendly output. We need more right-wing comedians. People saying, but there aren't any right-wing comedians. You know.
Well, there are. Not there are all sorts.
Apart from in the cabinet.
I think the best comedians aren't left-wing or right-wing. They just take the mickey out of both of them.
There are various people saying, well, the problem with one guy was saying about it, who's a comedian currently on the BBC, I don't necessarily...
Do they have comedy on the BBC?
Well, they do, apparently.
This is news
to me. And he's saying the real problem is we can't find anybody that's right-wing that's actually good enough to be on.
That's why they put all these unfunny left-wing comedians on, isn't it?
Well, I mean, I think the fact of the matter is that...
Mark Thomas doesn't get a look in.
No, he doesn't. In other words, he's definitely not going to get a look in under the new setup.
In fact, even Rory Bremner.
Bring back Bernard Manning, that's what I say.
Even Rory Bremner seems to be booted out of broadcasting.
Has been for ages.
Yeah.
Well, do you know, he was at the...
He's Channel 4, though.
Newsnight interviewed Rory Bremner, Newsnight. And they basically said, well, why aren't you on any longer? And he said, well, they won't let me on. He said, they did invite me on, but to do a travel programme.
So this starts... OK, so we're getting into now a fascinating area, which is the BBC and the other main broadcasters just... trying to ban comedy. It's a bit like the Puritans. Yeah. It's a bit like the Civil War.
Well, it's banning certain kinds of comedy.
Martin, okay, we have to agree to disagree on this. I haven't seen anything really good comedian. All of the good stuff, in fact, Charlie Skelton and his programme, Friday Night Live that he used to do, all that's been banned, everything's gone. The idea, I think, is to demoralise the nation. Just don't give them anything to smile and laugh about anymore.
Well, I don't think it's a war on comedy. It's a war on certain kinds of ideas. Rory Bremner's stuff in the run-up to the Iraq War was forensic. Absolutely forensic.
Okay, so very detailed. Anyway, let's have a listen to Prime Minister's questions on the BBC now.
Andrew Lloyd.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. When I buy a copy of The Mirror, The Mail or The Telegraph, I'm not required to buy a copy of The Guardian. And yet when I want to watch live TV on Sky, Amazon Prime or ITV, I am forced to pay for the BBC. Does the Prime Minister believe that this is a sustainable situation in the medium or longer term?
My honourable friend makes a very interesting point, the point of view that I'm sure shared by many people in this country, but my right honourable friend, the Secretary of State for Culture, Media and Sport, will be setting out a roadmap shortly for reform of the BBC and addressing the very issue that he mentions.
So no real answer there. Again, I think maybe you're right about Boris. You know, he just doesn't seem to want to answer the questions. But the point is really important about the BBC. Is it valued, Ian? Do you think we should keep it or not?
Difficult question, isn't it? Because there's so much rubbish and they do so much laundering, you know, of official stories. But then on the other hand, if you look really hard, there was always that joke, wasn't there, about the New York Times? They said that the most interesting thing about the New York Times is what page the front page story is going to be. Because, you know, they do tell the truth.
They bury it.
And there's been a couple of very interesting stories about COVID on the BBC website lately. One of them suggesting that in India, the reason they've had such a low death rate might be because everybody lives on top of each other and they all get flu. They don't have flu jabs. They all get colds and flu, and that gives them more resistance.
Yeah.
And another article telling us how some researchers have found that there are T cells, which some people have, who haven't had COVID, but do give you a certain amount of immunity to it. So it could be that, you know, we're getting the truth there. On the other hand, you know, they'll routinely make statements which are untrue.
Martin, there's a big difference, though, isn't there, between your sort of network BBC in London and the main, you know, the main networks, which are national, and regional BBCs, is quite a different kettle of fish.
Yeah, well, I think the fundamental question here is that should there be an obligation on certain media outlets for to be not so much unbiased as to present a spectrum of views? Because in actual fact, as we know, freedom of speech means you can say whatever you like. Here we are online at the minute, and we can say pretty much what we like. Whereas, of course, if we were being broadcast by BCFM, you can be...
Well, I would have had to bleep one of the words in our poem we just had from Castle Park, for example.
Indeed, and of course, so the question is, are we just going to have a free-for-all where everybody just says what they want, like that Tory MP saying, why should I pay for the BBC when I don't agree with this, some of the political opinions on it? And the answer is that as things stand, broadcast media like that are supposed to show impartiality across their output. And that applies both to the BBC, to RT, to Bristol Community Radio, to Press TV, supposedly, and they broke it, and that's why they're not allowed to be on the platform. Now, what the Tories are planning to do here is, I mean, the guy they put in is very clearly, they're going to...
This is Tim Davey,
yeah, they're going to discipline the BBC, because a lot of right-wingers think that the BBC is left-wing. I'm left-wing, and as far as I'm concerned, the BBC is right-wing. but, I mean, that's not the point, is it? The point is, are we going to have a system of broadcast where they're supposed to be impartial, or we're going to get rid of that? In which case, I can call for the assassination of the Prime Minister, and there should be no comeback.
I was going to say, I mean, it's actually about impartiality, really. I think that's what you need. You need to have both sides, and if the BBC aren't going to do that, then there should be some form of accountability.
But Murdoch wants to bring in an alternative to the BBC, which will be a Daily Mail BBC. That is his plan.
But it seems to be being sabotaged to me. That's what I'm saying. As an ex-BBC person myself...
Oh, the BBC is being sabotaged,
it's
absolutely.
Inside and out. So you've got editors and managers who are destroying it. I mean, we heard last week from Steve Brodie, former Home Affairs correspondent here at Points West and BBC South West Region, that what you've got is you've got all these managers who never appear on air. They don't do any kind of work actually for the public on air. But they're being paid astronomical amounts. So you were to sack one or two of those. In fact, if you were to sack them all and replace them with people who were on air, you'd have something like 400 staff in the regions that are now at the moment under threat of redundancy. So, and that's for, I think it was from memory last week, was 35 or 37 top executives being paid between £100,000 and £350,000.
It's an extraordinary number that I know that the Evening Standard did a survey into it.
So these people are effectively, these top managers are sabotaging the corporation.
Yes, and if Murdoch's TV station comes ahead, they'll go and work for that TV station. They'll be paid even double the money.
If they were all
sacked, because it's private sector, and therefore it doesn't matter.
If they were all sacked, the whole world could breathe a sigh of relief. But anyway, more from Prime Minister's questions now. And the schools are back, and HS2 has started.
My right honourable friend will be well aware that, welcome though it is, the start of the new term this week will be challenging for all schools. It will be particularly so for Burton Green Church of England Academy in my constituency, where HS2 has just closed the road that many parents use to access the school. It's done that for several months with little notice or consultation, and contrary to assurances given during the passage of the HS2 bill. This is not, as my right honourable friend well knows, the first or only example of high-handedness or poor communication on the part of HS2. So will he please help me to require of HS2 that it does better for the people of Burton Green and elsewhere on the route?
Prime Minister?
Yes, Mr. Speaker. Well, I heartily endorse, I'm afraid, the sentiments that he's expressed. Anybody who's worked with HS2 over the last few years will know that they do treat local residents with, I'm afraid, a high-handed approach, or have done. And what I can tell him, however, is that where there is damage to local roads, HS2 will pay compensation. I will certainly take his point up with HS2.
Can I have comments, Martin, from you first, maybe about the schools, and then both of you about HS2? I mean, you actually back at school now, or what?
I imagine I'll be going back in next week. I've been talking to my direct employers about that.
Okay. Schools generally. Well, what about HS2? Is this good value for money?
I don't think so. I mean, really, it's a big white elephant style project. What they should be doing is rebuilding the beaching railways in the peripheral parts of Britain. Rather, you see, the problem with putting lines that lead to London is that instead of taking demand out of London and putting it in Birmingham and Leeds and Manchester, you basically mean that everything flows back to London. So what you need is connectivity between Leeds and Manchester rather than Leeds.
Well,
and
one
London.
Of the peculiar things about Extinction Rebellion is they seem to be quite anti-trains, bizarrely. Although I would have thought this was the best place for people to go if they're not going to go on a car, is a tram or a train, where.
Well, that doesn't mean HS2.
No. What do you make of HS2, Ian?
Well, I don't have too many opinions. I had noticed Martin's point, which is that it's more likely to suck money into London than to draw it out of London. That seems fairly clear.
I mean, it's going to be a little bit quicker. I think it's sort of 20 minutes quicker getting from Birmingham to London.
It's hardly worth it, is it?
It does seem an awful lot of money to pay just to save 20 minutes off a train journey.
Well, we had Manfred Petrisch on this show, must have been, 2 years ago now, from All Smoke and Mirrors blog. When I explained to him that it was going to be around about £111 billion it was going to cost for these railway lines. He was a Swiss financier, and he used to finance railways. He did sort of 30 years in Switzerland financing all sorts of things, including railways, and he just laughed like a drain. He said, for that, you could build a railway around the world.
Well, you could write off Britain's budget deficit, practically.
Thank goodness for the magic money tree, that's all I can say.
Okay, also, lots of dinghies coming across the channel this week.
Lee Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Our nation has a proud history as a safe haven for desperate souls. But now, the asylum system is broken and being abused. So, the people of Ashfield would like to know, when will the Prime Minister introduce legislation to fix the asylum system, which will save lives by taking back control of our borders?
Prime Minister.
I thank my honourable friend, and I have a great deal of sympathy with those who are so desperate as to put their children in dinghies or even children's paddling pools and try to cross the channel. But I have to say that what they are doing is falling prey to criminal gangs, and they are breaking the law. They're also undermining the legitimate claims of others who would seek asylum in this country. And that is why we will take advantage of leaving the EU by changing the Dublin regulations on returns. And we will address the rigidities in our laws that make this country, I'm afraid, a target and a magnet for those who would exploit vulnerable people in this way.
So Boris Johnson, not really committing to very much, just saying basically it's against the law. I mean, you down in Brighton, do you come across any of this down in that part of the world, of the channel crossers, and what do you make of it all?
Well, what strikes me is how few people, I mean, you know, on the Mediterranean countries, following the overthrow of Colonel Gaddafi by Britain and France primarily, what he predicted has happened, and there is now a route from sub-Saharan Africa all the way through to London and Frankfurt. I mean, my friends in Germany, in Heidelberg, they tell me that most of the asylum seekers in Germany, that they're not Syrians. According to the media, they're Syrians, but they're not. They're sub-Saharan Africans who've come in through the Libya route. And so, you know, seeing as we started the war in and we destroyed Libya, it seems a bit rich to moan about people making money out of the refugees that are trying to escape from there.
Martin, we're talking about 400 plus migrants in one day this week, roughly 1,500 crossing the channel in a month.
Well, I mean, there's lots of people on the move all over the world, and I'd just like to reiterate what Ian said there about the destruction of Libya.
Would you encourage these people to come to Britain?
No, I wouldn't necessarily encourage them to come to Britain. I wouldn't necessarily. What we really need to do is to change the whole global setup. So, for example, day in, day out, billions of pounds comes into the city of London from the countries they're fleeing from.
Well, hang on, because this is actually...
And they're following that money.
This is actually the mafia that they're coming, they're bringing them over. They're making a lot of money. They're making money out of every successful migrant that comes across.
That's true, but the Mafia are making money out of it because we knocked down Colonel. What Colonel Gaddafi was doing in Libya was he was actually providing work for people from sub-Saharan Africa. They were expanding the economy there, and they said, "Come here as legitimate migrants, and we will put you to work." That's all been smashed.
I think the Mafia is a bit of a red herring. They're like the sort of parasites, aren't they? That lands on
they,
wounds.
They have very good linkages into the highest levels of all of this.
But Germany's taken 1 million, I think. And what about Syria during the Iraq invasion and the mayhem that we caused there? Syria took, I think, literally millions of Iraqis fled to Syria.
Right.
You know, we are one of the meanest, most selfish countries when it, I'm sorry to say this, you know, when it comes to this sort of issue.
Most refugees are refugees within their own countries. There's been 7.5 million people displaced in Colombia by the US-backed government. Then the most people after that are the people who've just got crossed one border from, for example, Iraq into Syria.
I mean,
these are often the very poor countries. So around Somalia, Kenya's taken most of the.
But Martin, this was going on for years and years on the border of Mexico. I think is it San Isidro and San Diego down there between there and is it California at the bottom? This has been going on for years and years. It's well known. The big companies in the United States have been lobbying for this. They've been shoveling money to the Mafia to bring them lots of cheap labour. That seems to be now happening in Europe.
No, it's not.
Across
it's
the
not
Mediterranean
just a question of cheap,
and across the Channel.
You've got to distinguish between the different. There's lots of different people who are moving for different reasons. Some people are running away from wars. Some people are running away from political persecution. Some people are running away from economic catastrophe. Yeah,
these
but they're all
migrants.
Mixed up.
Most of these people are economic migrants.
They're looking for a better life.
I mean, no one's blaming them for looking for a better life, but that's what they're doing.
They're also running away from situations which are intolerable where they come from. Most countries in Africa have been looted since the 1980s completely. All basic development has stopped in the developing world since the Reagan-Thatcher revolution. What we should have been doing all along is allowing countries to pursue economic policies which are good
for
their own
we've done is in these old colonial parts of the world we've created a hostile environment for ordinary people and they're just desperate to get out get to somewhere where they can make a living.
That's right. And it's not just make a living, it's survive in many cases. There is the legal position is that all countries have to accept asylum seekers who are genuinely fleeing from persecution or war. Now, in actual fact, a lot of these people are fleeing from war zones. And I tell you, if you were watching the Serbian army come over the hill to kill your children, you would pick up your children and you would run. And you would run in the direction of anywhere you could go. And that's what happens. And that was in Yugoslavia, but it's the same going on in Sudan, Somalia, all these other countries where the West has intervened. In Iraq, we've killed 1 million people and devastated the country.
I would dispute that the majority of these people are fleeing from war zones. I think they're just fleeing from poverty.
No, it's not true, Tony. The Eritreans who make up a big...
Well,
a big,
I think
a big
what you're saying is not true, yes?
Well,
let's just have a difference of opinion,
all right,
please.
Well, I think a lot of them are actually fleeing from war zones, Tony.
And I think a lot of them are fleeing from poverty. Anyway, Ian, you have the final
Poverty can be often, you know, caused or made a lot worse by war.
Yeah,
there is a small element,
Libya,
I think, who are just basically, you know, yes, they're economic migrants, but then they've just been watching American TV programs and they want two houses and four cars.
Anyway, look, let's wind up the Prime Minister's questions look at this week by looking at the small businesses that are finding it impossible to get Rishi Sunak's wonderful loans.
Let me pull in red.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The Bounce Back Loan Scheme has been a huge success, delivered by the Prime Minister and indeed the Chancellor. 1.3 million loans being granted, vital support for SMEs. But the All-Party Group on Fair Business Banking, which I co-chair, has established there are 250,000 businesses who currently bank with fintechs and alternative lenders who do not have access to those loans because they cannot get access to the Bank of England's term funding scheme. And lenders who do have those loans are not really accepting loan applications from new customers. Would the Prime Minister use his best offices to persuade the Governor of the Bank of England to open up the term funding scheme to those alternative finance organisations, or open the doors of other lenders who can provide those schemes, those loans, to other SMEs?
Prime Minister.
Well, I thank my honourable friend. He raises an important point. Those, as he will know, the rules around access to schemes for alternative finance are not the responsibility of my right honourable friend, the Chancellor, but for the Bank of England. But I'm sure the Governor will have heard him today.
I'm sure the Governor of the Bank of England will have heard him. Well, that's not really very giving any great commitment.
I'm a small businessman, actually. I've got my coffee shop in Portobello Road in London. And the first thing, of course, that you notice as a businessman, and probably anybody else as well, is that they're talking about loans. Well, loans have to be paid back, you know. Now, so if it's, you know, if you've just lost a heap of money due to lockdown, you know, why would you borrow a whole lot of money to cover that? You know, weren't we always told by Mrs. Thatcher that borrowing's a bad thing?
It's an interesting, isn't it, that the stock market and the property bubble has just been gifts. It's been gifts to the stock market, Martin, and yet we're being told small businesses that, well, you're going to have to pay it back, chum. The stock market doesn't have to, though.
Well, the other thing, of course, is they're channeling it through the banks. If you were going to have a government-backed scheme of loans or whatever, you could have soft loans, for example, by the government. Mm. Why give it to the banks? That's just more. And of course, the banks have not picked up on this because there's no money in it for them with the small businesses.
Yeah, the banks aren't interested.
They're just not interested in it, and so it's like pushing on a string to try and get the banks to lend to these small businesses. And as Ian points out, what use is a loan anyway? It's just, I mean, what you need to do is protect the economy through injecting demand. The obvious thing to do is have a generous universal credit, basic income.
Exactly.
Which would have been like an airbag. As we hit this wall, the airbag would have gone on, and the small businesses would then be survived as people spent money in small businesses, and you know that would have protected the economy. But we didn't do it,
and we know that that's right, because looking at it historically, the social security system that was introduced in 1945 by the left wing Labour government, you know, that's been credited with stabilising the economy, just because even those rather mean levels of support which people get helps to, you know, rebalance.
So why aren't we hearing any of this from Mr. Starmer, Martin?
Well, I mean, he's basically said pretty much the same sort of things as we've done, but very, very sotto voce. His political problem is he doesn't want to be seen. When he got elected, Boris Johnson had a massive opinion poll boost because he just got ill and everybody was rallying around the government. And therefore, he felt that he had to just kind of be seen to be constructive, but not to be too critical and so on. He's gradually finding that it's actually, you know, because Boris Johnson is frankly, even from his own side's point of view, are not a very good football player, things are moving in Starmer's direction.
Okay, we're going to go to have some music in a minute. But before we finish, Kilmersdown and Mells this week, this is back in June. We missed this story completely, Martin, but John Bradenkamp apparently has died. This is this Rhodesian or Zimbabwe-born arms dealer that lives in Somerset that we have alleged on this programme has been involved in various dodgy deals to do with the Conservative Party and nuclear weapons used for fundraising for the Tories. Can you just say a little bit about Bradenkamp? Because we've got this quite an interesting little kind of, down at the villages of places like Kilmersdon and Mells, this kind of Rhodesian, rather right-wing contingent hanging around down there.
Yeah, and they're also married into the local Tory squirearchy and quite chummy with the Rees-Mogg family. Bradenkamp knows is very chummy with the Rees-Mogg family. Anyway, he supposedly died in Zimbabwe. He fought in the war.
Kidney failure, I think.
Yeah, he fought in the war in Zimbabwe. He was in the Rhodesian SAS along with his colleague Billy Reutenbach, who also lives in that part of the world. And we have information. We were given information that they were involved in the sale of South Africa's nuclear weapons at the end of apartheid. Now, there's a big story there. But anyway, the nuclear weapons were sold, but then they went missing. And the Tory party in 92 got lots of money on the back of that sale. I don't think we've got time to go into all the details.
No, but I wonder, is this story going to be buried with John Bradenkamp?
Well, the thing about this is, what my informant tells me is that he suspects that Bradenkamp isn't in fact dead.
Oh, God.
That in fact he lives in Mells and Kilmersdown, and but he's gone to Zimbabwe because he's not been back to Zimbabwe for years, but he's got loads of connections there. Therefore,
he's an interesting character in that he was quite friendly with Ian Smith, but then also with Mugabe.
Yes, because he's
involved with BAE arms deals.
Yes, that's right. I mean, he's basically a very dodgy arms dealer. I mean, that's what he's known for. I mean, his assets have been frozen for a number of years. My informant tells me that that's probably because of the nuclear weapons.
Well, that
business.
Is interesting, isn't it? Because if he's died, surely those assets are now going to be unfrozen.
That's right. So therefore, it may well be that this is a fake death.
Oh, God.
And that in actual fact, he's still alive, but his will can now be enacted. Because there's a massive gold bond in the Union Bank of Switzerland.
That's right, bullion bond.
Yeah, which is the proceeds of the nuclear weapons sale from years ago. And if he's by dying, inverted commas, that means that his assets can become unfrozen and he can pay off his creditors. Because the way this whole thing was financed is they went round the top of the Tory party in 1992 and said, you know what the deal is. You give us some money, and in 2 weeks' time, we're going to double your money. But don't ask us what
so
we're doing.
So, does Jacob Rees-Mogg know about all this?
I'm reliably told that he does.
That's interesting, isn't it? It's actually an interesting thing to know about. No, maybe isn't there also a letter confirming some of this?
Written
by Tony Blair to Dan Norris, the former MP down there.
That's right. Now.
Because that letter would be an interesting bit of evidence, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Well, anyway, the point this all sounds terribly mysterious because we're not naming the source, but because he doesn't want to be named.
So we know it's a he.
Tell him, Pike.
I think they probably know who the source is. But anyway, so the long and short of it is Jacob could be wrapped up in this nasty little deal.
Well, I think the long and short of it, he is. And the point is that the whole Tory party got £17.5 million to spend. Was it £17.5 million? I think it was, on the 1992 election. And there was a question in the House of Commons, where did that money come from? And it was basically...
I think it was Tam Dio asked it, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah. And it came from the proceeds of this deal.
That's rather interesting. I mean, this is nuclear arms dealing. It's not... Is that a criminal offence?
Yes, it is. Of course, Magnus Malan approached... approached Bredenkamp and others and said, the blacks are about to take over in South Africa. We've got 9 nuclear warheads. There was 10, but one of them exploded in a test. But you don't want him to have them. We don't want him to have them. We are prepared to sell them to the Western powers. So both the British and the Americans agreed that they would buy these warheads under the table. And the Americans brought 6 of them, and that left 3 that were to be bought by the British. But Bredenkamp interspersed himself into the next MI6 officer called Stephen Koch. They set up a company which was Astra.
Part of Astra Holdings.
Holdings, which was Astra Fireworks. And they paid for the 3 warheads. And then they sold them on to the British government at a profit. But, unfortunately, Bredenkamp double-crossed Astra Holdings and took the money and then didn't hand over the warheads. And they then disappeared into the black market. But at the same time, the Tory party itself was given a lot of money as a result of this, which helped them to win the 92 election.
I wonder how easy these nuclear weapons are to trace, because we don't really want nuclear weapons finding their way onto the black market, thank you very much, especially if it's used as a fundraising trick for the Conservative
Party. Well, indeed,
party.
So this is the real scandal underlying all of this. And there's also information that he may have actually got further plutonium warheads from a B-52 bomber that crashed off the coast of Somalia.
But then it could all be complete nonsense. Who
it
knows?
Could.
We'll be right back. there's anything left to me. Don't let these shakes go on. It's time we had a break from it. It's time we had some leave. We've been living in flames. We've been eating up our brains. Oh, please don't let these shakes go on. You ask me why I'm weary, why I can't speak to you. You blame me for my silence, say it's time I change the rule. But the war's still going on, dear, and there's no end that I know. And I can't say it forever. I can't say if we're ever gonna be free. Don't let these shakes go on. It's time we had a break from it.
From 1981. It's from an album called The Fire of Unknown Origin, Blue Oyster Cult, and it's a veteran of the Psychic Wars, which I feel like sometimes myself. Welcome back to Not the BCFM's Politics Show with author of 9/11 Revealed Ian Henshaw and Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, and me, Tony Gosling. This week, Charlie Hebdo terror trials are happening this week. Why has it taken 5 years for the French establishment to get their story straight and bring those arrested into court? And as Russian dissident Alexei Navalny lies sick in a Berlin hospital, apparently poisoned with Novichok, what is US spy Vil Sultanovich Mirzyanov's role in the decades-long Novichok story? Is it actually as dangerous, Novichok, as we've been told? And what about Alexander Litvinenko, who's also supposed to have been poisoned by Putin back in 2006? Only his brother, sister and father don't think he was. And the British inquest only said he probably was. Did he ever really work as a spy? Or was Litvinenko just a former policeman trying to sell protection to gullible Western visitors to a newly opened up Russia? And more to the point, trying to blackmail criminal oligarchs in London, which could have gotten him killed. Also, next week, it's the anniversary of the 2001 9/11 attacks, with the official story in pieces and evidence pointing to the Israeli Secret Service, in conjunction with traitors within the United States government and military actually being behind these attacks. We get the views of former psychological warfare officer Scott Bennett, airline pilot and author of The Big Bamboozle, Philip Marshall, producer of the In Plain Sight video, Dave von Kleist, and we hear the testimony of National Security Advisor on the day, Richard Clark, all under the expert eye of author of 9/11, The New Evidence, who's joined us here in the studio. And finally, a medieval satanic group infiltrating monotheistic faiths, hell-bent on privatising the earth so they could buy it up for their own private property, an English king that stood in their way and had his head removed for his trouble. The author of The Dying God we heard from last week, giving his view on the origins of the fake Jewish Kabbalah, one of the world's best scholars and authors on the topic, the author of Transhumanism, The History of a Dangerous Idea as well, his name David Livingstone. So this week on the Rosicrucians and the role of Francis Bacon and John Dee in paving the way for a militant atheist establishment behind the British Empire that built the New World Order of today. That's our final item tonight. But we start, I think, with Charlie Hebdo. Just on the basic point, Martin, why is it that 5 years after, it's taken 5 years for this to actually come to court? What on earth is going on?
Well, I have to say, I don't quite know what's going on in particular relation to this court case. But we do know that most of this kind of terrorist activity has links back to Western security forces. And the Kouachi brothers, who were named as the main culprits, they looked to me as if they were patsies, and they took their passports with them on the operation, etc. The usual stuff where there's various clues are left to make people assume that what they know what's happened.
But I mean, I'm trying to make the point here, really, that this is very suspicious. That why is the establishment taking such a long time to put these people on trial if it's such an open and shut case? And as we're told by the press, who's done it, that should be over within a year.
There's a general sort of rule with all these cases. I'm thinking going back to 9/11 as well. The things that they have the most difficulty making stand up slow it all down. So the collapse of World Trade Center 7, for instance, which is the most difficult thing for them to explain in 9/11, took them about 10 years before they came out with a technical report, which was full of riddles, but that's another issue. So yeah, if something takes a long time, somebody spoke to Ken Livingstone about 9/11, and he said, he laughed, and he said, well, if you're right, it'll be 150 years before they tell us the truth about it. And I think that's it, isn't it? They have to go slowly when it's always more difficult creating something which isn't true than reporting on something that is true.
One thing I'm going to be very, very fascinated to see if they come up with anything about this at the trials. Finally, Commissioner Helric Fredu, he's the forgotten policeman in this. He was part of the official investigation. Yeah. His passing whilst participating in the Charlie Hebdo investigation has barely been acknowledged. His death in Limoges, southwest France, is shrouded in mystery. Allegedly committed suicide within hours of a police debriefing in the preparation of his police report. His funeral was held privately. The official story is he was depressed and had suffered from a burnout following a meeting with relatives of one of the victims. No details as to who these relatives were, where they were living. The reports fail to mention that the Kouachi brothers had spent their high school years in the Limoges region and that the Commissionaire Ferru's police investigation was in all probability related to gathering information within the region on the Kouachi brothers, or Kouali brothers, including their whereabouts. An autopsy was performed, but he died. He was very much involved in the investigation, and suddenly Martin is dead.
Yes, I mean, I haven't prepared to discuss Charlie Hebdo, and of course, because it happened so long ago, relatively speaking, my memory is not as good as it might be. But I mean, the patterns are fairly clear. Lots of things, like having suicide bombers, for example, means that there is never any trial anyway. So you don't even bother to have a trial. We all know who did this. And as Tony Blair said after 7-7, having an inquiry would be a ludicrous diversion. We all know who did it. It's these guys here. And, of course, since they're all dead, there's no reason for us to have any further investigation.
OK, so today we're hearing from Pakistan. Thousands are protesting over there over the reprinting of these anti-Mohammed cartoons in France. So it's almost as if because the trial's taking place, the newspapers are now reprinting and circulating the cartoons. That cause
the anti-Islam lobby, isn't it? You know, that it's all fairly predictable, really, I suppose.
Yeah, but it's, I mean, if those cartoons have been ridiculing Judaism, we'd be hearing accusations of anti-Semitism.
Yeah, crikey, by goodness.
So why is it okay to ridicule Islam and not Judaism then?
Well, exactly.
Well, there is no reason. I mean, either everybody can say everything or people have got to show some respect, one or t'other.
Yeah.
Do you think these sorts of terror trials, do they usually end up with any sort of fair verdict? What can we expect, do you think, from the French?
They usually plead guilty, don't they? The standard pattern is the defence lawyer goes in, explains to them if they want to not get executed, in America at least, then they'd best agree with the story that the prosecutors have come up with. I mean, I'm not saying it's always not true, but, you know, it's that's the problem in America particularly. You've got this plea bargaining, and once you're accused of a, you know, capital offence, you've got the most massive interest. You've got to be a very brave person to keep up the denial. Much easier to just plead guilty. And
well, officially, three police officers were killed and honoured by President Hollande at a state funeral, and this all happened back in January 2015. I just think it's extraordinary that it takes so long for justice to the wheels of justice to start moving. And that, to me, is a red rag to a bull, or a red flag, certainly, in this case, that there's something dodgy going on here. We shall see. Anyway, the other big story of the week, Martin, has been about this guy, Alexei Navalny. You've been, again, I think, I'm popping up on RT, talking about this. So who is this Alexei Navalny in the first place, before we talk about him suddenly being taken ill on a plane and being flown to Germany?
Well, he's a political figure, fairly well known in Russia itself. He's always been opposed to the current government. He's quite associated with the Yabloko, which was a very pro-neoliberal party, which has got very minimal support these days in Russia. So opinion polls give him between 1% and 2% support. So he is a political figure, but he's not nearly as important as somebody like Nigel Farage, for example, in this country. But, of course, he's presented in the West as this knight in shining armour, exposing Putin's corruption, etc., etc. But, of course, there are other political forces which are much more significant, like the Communist Party and the Liberal Democrat Party in the Russia, which are far more significant in terms of opposing Putin than Navalny. So, but, of course, Navalny and his acolytes are funded directly and indirectly by the National Endowment for Democracy, which is basically US taxpayers pay them to do the sort of thing we're doing here for nothing. And they go around trying to change things from their own point of view and not getting very far.
So what is he? I mean, we keep hearing about him being an important political figure over there. But, I mean, you could also look at it as well. He's basically past his sell-by date. He's not really got much of a political traction in Russia. And it might be that he's more useful doing something else if he's... How close do we know how close he is to the Western intelligence services?
Oh, he's pretty close. I mean, you can presume... I mean, one of the things I was pointing out about this is because he's known as an anti-corruption campaigner. So he goes around and he doesn't just attack the government. He attacks, you know, local officials who are on the take and so on. That's how he tries to gain traction. So some of them might have some motive for doing him some ill. Also, of course, his entourage will be massively infiltrated by Western intelligence. And if they wanted to do him some ill, they could. And then you say, well, the Western intelligence wouldn't do something like that. I would say, well, what happened with Boris Berezovsky in 2013 in this country, where he was basically thinking of going back to Russia. And he'd written a letter to Putin's because he fell out with Putin very badly. And of course, he then funded lots of Russian political movements in Ukraine and elsewhere. Basically, his security detail disappeared for the afternoon. And when they came back from shopping, he'd hung himself in the bathroom.
And they never made a song and dance about it.
No, they didn't make any song and dance about it at all. But the But the coroner...
It was the Israelis doing his security, by the way.
Well, I don't know who was doing his security.
Former IDF people.
Was it? I didn't know that. But anyway, that's interesting. But the point is that, yes, they didn't make... You'd have thought this guy, who's... the coroner refused to sign it up. The British state said, no, he committed suicide. But his daughter wasn't happy with that, and she brought in experts on things like hanging from Germany to testify in the coroner's court. And the coroner, to his credit, refused to write it off as suicide. He said, I'm going to give an open verdict here, because it's quite possible there has been some foul
play. But
what's
the relationship between Navalny and Berezovsky?
The point I'm trying to make is that it's quite possible for the Western powers to kill people who are supposedly their allies as part of a political manoeuvre. I know it's hard for people to get their head round, but basically, they're expendable. Somebody like Navalny is never going to replace Putin. He's got no chance of doing that whatsoever. But by poisoning him, you can create an incident. And of course, this incident has been created now. The Bundeswehr's laboratories have said it was Novichok. We will come back to discuss what Novichok is in a minute. And now, Angela Merkel is coming under pressure from the Greens and people in her own party to cancel the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which is just about to come on stream, bringing gas directly from Siberia into North Germany. And the Americans have been trying to close this down for several months.
What is the Nord Stream 2? What economic and what political implications are there to it?
Well, Nord Stream 2 was started after the business in the Ukraine, which of course was started with a massacre in the Maidan Square, which a court in Kiev has now definitively said was not carried out by the police, but was carried out by a probably NATO-organised death squad.
They killed that doesn't sound very definitive, a probably NATO...
No, the people who did it testified. It was Shakashvili who brought 50 snipers in from Georgia, and they testified in the court on a video link that they were the ones who'd shot the protesters. Those protesters were pro-EU. The NATO intelligence service were quite happy to kill them. Boris Berezovsky is one of Putin's major opponents. It looks as if the British were quite happy to kill him because the family of Berezovsky are convinced that he was murdered, but they don't blame the Russians, they blame the British. And of course, we were talking earlier about Brigadier Gordon Kerr and the Loyalist terror campaign in Northern Ireland.
Well, the thing with
British
Berezovsky,
don't kill people is wrong.
You've just said that, but the thing with the British is that they didn't necessarily want Berezovsky blabbing around London about everything about all this kind of underworld activity between Russia and Britain.
It may well be that both Berezovsky and Skripal were thinking of going back to Russia, and because they'd been embedded with MI6 for quite a long time, they'd have lots of things to talk to the FSB about. So there's your motive.
Okay, on Novichok, this substance, it didn't kill the Skripals, which is amazing, really, if it's a potent nerve agent. There's also those other people in Salisbury who did die, apparently due to Novichok, were handling the perfume bottle. Apparently it was all over their hands, and yet it didn't kill them. There was police messages about the dangers of fentanyl just a few days before this sort of second thing happened with the perfume bottle and these other people. Now we've got Alexei Navalny apparently being poisoned with Novichok and not dying. How potent is this stuff, Martin?
Well, it doesn't seem to be very potent at all.
Nerve agents are pretty dangerous.
Well, I mean, also the Skripal's house was demolished because it was apparently contaminated with it, even though it had just been sprayed on a doorknob. But there you go. I mean, the illogicalities of the story just scream out at anybody who's got a logical frame of mind. Well, it just doesn't add up. I mean, there are plenty of, before we come to explanations of what really did happen, we can be pretty certain what didn't happen. Yeah. And in any case, if Novichok had failed to kill Skripal, why would the evil FSB try to use the same useless Novichok again and fail again?
Okay, let me just say, give you my little, I think is a little bit of inside information about Novichok. These Novichoks are real compounds. They were studied in the USSR at a bench scale in the 1970s, at a time when several countries were studying possible new nerve agents. The story of a secret program in the late 1980s and 90s to develop a chemical superweapon called Novichok was fabricated by Soviet counterintelligence to successfully flush Vil Sultanovich Mezhenov out as a US spy and a leaker, and continued after the collapse of USSR to confuse the United States. So this is an interesting angle on all of this, Martin, is that this Novichok could have been a chemical compound given to this guy, Mirzanov, in order to see if he would pass it to the West. And he did, because the Russians had their spies in the West that saw all this stuff appearing to the Western intelligence. So they realized they must have got it from him. He was not long after that. I mean, it was basically an authentic-looking secret material which he was deliberately given access to test his loyalty, and it did indeed find its way to the United States. He was then arrested in 1992, but the trial collapsed under Yeltsin, and Mirzanov moved to the United States in 1995. The US studied the toxicity of these compounds around 1996, and all indications were they're not as toxic anywhere near as toxic as sarin or VX, the much better known nerve agents invented, I think, by the Nazis, in fact, which are apparently gotten rid of. But these are the really dangerous nerve agents. The structures of Novichoks have been publicly available since 2008, so anyone with a reasonable lab can make them at bench scale. So that what I'm trying to do here is to suggest that this is, I think, the real story of Novichok. It's a type of nerve agent which was used. It wasn't very potent, so they knew it was. There was no worries about giving all this information to the West, but it was used to flush out a spy, and they did it like that successfully.
That sounds very interesting. And of course, the main thing from the theatre point of view is that Novichok sounds a very evil sort of Russian sort of nerve agent, doesn't it?
Yeah. Made in Russia.
Yes, of course. And of course, this is why Novichok, if they'd said he'd been poisoned, like the Germans had said yesterday, he'd been poisoned, that would still have some credibility, because he might have been poisoned by one of his political opponents in Russia, not by the government.
And isn't it likely to have been someone of his entourage?
His entourage are the people who are closest to him, aren't they? The point is that they've got to call it Novichok. Now, Novichok, as presented in the Western media, is a really dangerous substance. You've just suggested that it isn't. But we were told this Novichok, you know, tiny things, it kills thousands, you know, of the whole of Salisbury. And of course, we've also heard that the house, as I mentioned earlier, has been demolished because it's been contaminated with Novichok. And of course, we saw at the time people with hazmat suits going around the place. Meanwhile, police officers are standing in uniform right next to the people with hazmat suits. That doesn't make sense, does it? Why have they got a hazmat suit on and you're just standing there, not even with a face mask? No face nappy, even.
Okay, so overall, Martin, anything to add about Navalny? What's going to happen? Is he going to survive? Is he going to be killed? Is he going to die of this poison?
Well, he is diabetic, because he's already said that, so that may well be that what we've had here is just... Let's just run through the logical possibilities. He's had a diabetic fit. Second, he's been poisoned, but not necessarily by Novichok. And if he has been poisoned, the question is who's done it. The head of the, not the GRU, but the civilian intelligence services in Russia this morning was saying that we suspect Western foul play here. And of course, as I said on RT yesterday, what you've got is this ridiculous scenario whereby we all know that Western intelligence services don't do nasty things like kill anybody. And certainly not kill people like Navalny, who's friendly to the West.
So what would be the motive let's just wrap up with the motive. What's the motive, it is the West?
Well, the motive is either related to what's going on in Belarus, which I don't think it probably is, because that's ongoing. What's very interesting is Angela Merkel, who is now come under pressure from her own party and from the Green Party to cancel the Nord Stream 2 pipeline.
Okay,
which
so
I just
Nord
mentioned.
Stream 2 is a pretty powerful motive. Actually,
yes, it is. That's a very strong
motive. And also, of course, she said she's going to be standing down next year. So she's kind of on her way out anyway.
Yes, well,
so why wouldn't she?
Well, she basically has stood up to the American bullying and British bullying about Nord Stream 2, because there's a substantial section of the industrialist establishment in Germany that wants cheap gas from Russia for industrial reasons. Of course, we don't do industry in this country anymore, so it's of no interest to us. You know, we just do bank fraud and things of that sort. But in Germany, you've still got an industrial base and they still want to make things. So for them, getting cheap gas, and of course the problem with putting it through Poland, the Poles are opposed to the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, because if there was going to be a pipeline, they wanted it to come through Poland. But both the Germans and the Russians are saying, yes, but then you can just turn off the tap at any time you want to, and we're not going to do that. And of course, that's what the problem with all the pipelines.
It's amazing much political influence there is just through energy. Of course, that's one of the reasons why we had the Bitter Lake deal back in the Second World War between Abdulaziz from Saudi Arabia, and I think it wasn't it Roosevelt that did this big deal about oil, which has so massively influenced the post-World War II world. But look, rather than concentrate too much on what happened in Salisbury and the Novichok there, which you mentioned briefly, there is an entire completely different narrative, which I read, I think it was on the SACA website, Martin, which I'll put a link up onto our show page at thisweek.org.uk, which gives you a complete different potential take from the official narrative of what happened at Salisbury by looking at Litvinenko. Now, this guy Litvinenko died in 2006, apparently of polonium poisoning, but there are some suspicions about who really did it, aren't there? Not least from his own family, Martin.
Well, that's right. I mean, when something like
this... We're told Putin did it, but...
Yeah, well, I mean, what, don't forget, there's something called Operation Beluga. We know it's called Operation Beluga because Captain Paul Birrell of the French anti-terrorist squad, who was also a part of... He retired from the anti-terrorist squad. He's part of Berezovsky's security detail. But he said there is something called Operation Beluga, which is run by the Western Intelligence Services, CIA, MI6, etc. And what Operation Beluga is about, a bit like Gladio back in the day, is whenever there's a potential for rapprochement and sensible cooperation between Russia and elements of in the West, so, for example, between German industrialists and Russian gas suppliers, then things happen to sabotage that. And this would fit that pattern to a T.
God, it sounds like an episode of the Avengers, you know, the old-fashioned 60s one. Anyway, Litvinenko, the Russian spy's brother, said he was killed by British agents. So his brother says that, and also Britain had more reasons to kill, apparently, Alexander Litvinenko than the Russians, claims the spy's brother. So we've got the brother saying very different things to what we've been hearing, and also his own father called Alexander Litvinenko a traitor, and he's begging forgiveness from Putin for Litvinenko being such a traitor. So various members of his own family, Martin, do not believe that Litvinenko was, you know, as we're being told, some sort of difficult opponent of Putin. Certainly one of the things I've heard is that he was actually quite a weedy guy. He certainly was nothing to do with the KGB, that he was an ex-policeman from St. Petersburg who was in London offering protection to British people who were travelling out to the newly opened up Russia, saying, well, if you go over there on your own without a delegation, you're going to be in danger, but I can oil the wheels, I know all the KGB people, I'll make sure you've got close protection and you'll be safe. So some people fell for that. Most people who knew what they were doing didn't, because they realised that it was just the whole thing was a confidence trick, really. He was just wanting money in order to do this close protection work. But his big mistake, apparently, Martin, was blackmailing some of the big oligarchs in London, saying, well, I know secrets about you from Russia, and so you better give me some money. But those people are quite dangerous criminals, and if he's blackmailing them, then there's an enormous motive there for one of them to bump him off, not Putin.
One thing I noticed was that nobody came up with any analysis of this polonium, did they? I mean, I read somewhere that you should be able to analyse it and find out exactly where it came from, because it could have been Russia, or it could have been Israel, I think, has polonium.
Well, that's what he probably used to poison Arafat.
Yeah, there was polonium found in Arafat's toothbrush and in his mouth. So polonium was used to kill him, apparently, too.
Well, I mean,
but if they had analysed it and found it was Russia, then they'd have told us, wouldn't they? So that tends to imply that...
Well, they've implied that it is, but, you know, they've not said it. I mean, you know, they've implied that it must be Russian. You see, things like polonium and Novichok are at a certain level. It can't be just random gangsters, it's got to be the state, which is why they push the line that this is what's been used.
Yeah.
Now, what we were told at the time, if you remember, Tony, was that the reason why the Russians wanted him dead was because he'd written the book with Yuri Feltinsky about blowing up Russia. And of course,
now, this gets to the heart of it,
mentioned. Now, people will remember what I call 999, which was in September, the ninth month of 1999. Bombs went off in Moscow and in Ryazan, in working-class neighbourhoods, killed hundreds of people.
Well, let's just be really clear about this. They blew up, like, half of a tower block, basically.
Yes, I mean, they were basically...
These were big residential tower blocks, like we've got here in Barton Hill.
Yeah, and it was claimed that this was the Chechens.
Massive bombs, like 30, 40 people.
At the same time, Samuel Basiev, who was a sort of militant Chechen commander, invaded Dagestan. Now, none of this really adds up, because by that stage... The Chechens had won independence from Russia. They were already independent of Russia. There was no reason for them to do anything like that. So it didn't make a lot of sense from that point of view. But Berezovsky was working with Yeltsin, because Yeltsin had just been re-elected in 1998 by a tiny majority, because the West poured money in to make sure that he won in the first round by, you know, an infinitesimal. He had to get more than 50%, so there wouldn't be a runoff. But, of course, the reason being that the challenger to him was Gennady Zyuganov of the Communist Party, and they were looking as if they were going to win, yeah? Because that's what happened everywhere else in Europe. The Communist Party won, but that wasn't acceptable to the Western powers. So what actually probably happened in Russia, in my view, to summarise, is that those bomb attacks in Russia were carried out with elements within the Russian security forces, but basically cooperating with Western security forces, doing the same kind of thing that they did at 9/11 and the same kind of thing they did at Bologna Railway Station in 1980. And, of course, people in Russia are well aware that there was no motive for the Chechens
to do this. Well, one of those bombs was actually discovered, wasn't it, I think, by an ordinary policeman who contacted the FSB or whoever they are, the state secret police, and they tried to make out that there was nothing to see. But he himself then got and defused one of the bombs in one of these tower blocks, so it never actually went off.
Well, one copper arrested some people who were acting suspiciously, and they were carrying a bomb, and they said, no, this is just a drill. Yeah, that's what he was told.
Yes, in other words, it
is possible that those bombs were planted from inside the security forces in Russia at the time. And I actually thought at the time that Putin was involved in it, because Putin had been appointed as Yeltsin's prime minister. So he was acting prime minister. And therefore, then Putin came forward and said, all right, we're going to deal with this. And, of course, Putin's power base came from that period, because he then took control as the prime minister. They reinvaded Chechnya. You know, they sorted things out. So it really built him up as some very
Berezovsky
important guy.
Thought he was in... he had Putin in his pocket, didn't
That's
he?
That's right. Well, Berezovsky was friendly with... Basically, he was a manipulator. And he got Basiev to carry out a provocation in Dagestan. And, of course, he controlled NTV, which was the biggest TV station in Russia at the time, and they were pushing Putin as the answer to the problem of the Chechens, yeah? So, but it was all really about stopping the communists coming to power and renationalising the economy.
I think it was in 2000, once Putin became president, he rather quickly went to the prosecutor's office and said, what have you got on Berezovsky?
Yeah, I mean, basically, Putin...
They fell out, didn't they?
Putin and Berezovsky fell out because
Berezovsky got a phone call from Putin saying they're going to come and arrest you in the morning. I'm an old mate of yours, and I'm just telling you, best thing is get on a plane tonight to London or somewhere out.
I mean, what happened there is Putin was regarded as a safe pair of hands by the FSB, who at that stage cooperating with that CIA and MI6 to keep the communists out. And at the time, I thought this was really sinister, because we're going to get Putin running the country, who's actually in the pocket of the CIA. But it turned out he wasn't in the pocket of the CIA, he was in his own pocket.
Renegade, as they say.
Anyway, so, yes, he is a gangster, I think it's fair to say, Mr. Putin, but he wants to be number one gangster in Russia. He's not having any of the oligarchs telling him what to do in the Kremlin.
He's no more or less of a gangster than Brigadier Gordon Kerr.
I'd say he's more. He's certainly got more power, hasn't he?
Mm.
But anyway, the idea is that you're not going to allow organised crime to push the Kremlin around.
Well, no, ultimately no. I mean, what's happened and why they're very hostile to Russia today, not the TV station, but Russia today, is because they've basically rebuilt the state on a more democratic basis than the United States of America. I mean, elections in Russia are pretty much free and fair. and the people with the most votes win. And of course, they're not going to privatise their natural resources.
You can check that by looking at opinion polls, I suppose.
Yes.
Finally, on this topic, Martin, what about Belarus? There's been a few shakes there. It's a little bit like Venezuela. The Western press, the Western establishment doesn't really seem to like the result.
No, and I think what happened at the beginning, Lukashenko is a bit of a control freak. He got elected 26 years ago because Belarus managed, as the Soviet Union broke up, Belarus just fell out of the Soviet Union. So it's a tiny country with less than 10 million inhabitants, largely not completely rural, but it's got a lot of big rural sector. And it was a backwater, really. And Lukashenko was a collective farm manager, a bit like Grudinin in Russia, who was the communist candidate at the last election there. And basically, he promised the population, we're not going to do anything to change things much around here. We're going to keep the collective farms going. They've still got collective farms in Belarus, and they employ people. People work all their lives, and then they get a pension, and they function. They've allowed them to collapse in other parts of Eastern Europe, which was absolutely disastrous for the rural population. But in Belarus, the rural population looked after. So all the grannies, you know, are looked after. And the big state factories, the Minsk tractor factory, the fertilizer factory, they employ thousands of people. And they've not been privatised, and everybody's still in work.
And if it's a successful socialist country, you may as well just carry on.
Well, the reason he was able to do that is because they get very cheap oil and gas from Russia itself. If he didn't have that, he would have had to
It's all back to energy again, isn't it?
Yes, it is. But anyway, the point about it is, reason I'm mentioning all of that is because a lot of Western analysis of what's happened there has failed to answer the basic questions. How's he stayed in power for 26 years? And the answer is, a bit like Shinzo Abe in the Liberal Democratic Party in Japan, it's because people vote for him. Now, of course, he's a bit of a control freak, so he basically, anybody that was perceived as opposition, he used to harass them, and, you know, he didn't really allow them to have a say. And, of course, that basically infuriated a younger generation. I mean, if you're a younger IT professional from Belarus, he's been in power, you know, you're less than 26 years old, he's been in power all your life. And, of course, you're fed up with him, and you'd like to see some change. But if you're an older rural voter, basically, he's delivered what he said. He does exactly what it says on the tin. We're not going to do anything like... And, of course, during the 1990s, when Yeltsin was in power in Russia, and they tried to privatise everything, and there was 1,000% inflation and collapsing economy, Belarus just chugged along. Backwater. And, in factual fact, they want to be a backwater.
And we mentioned Venezuela briefly there, Martin. Mentioned Venezuela, comparing it a little bit to the Belarus elections. Well, the Americans have been condemning that election in Venezuela last year, but they're now saying there's going to be another vote in December this year. But the Americans, Pompeo is saying to the Venezuelan opposition, boycott the election.
That's because they know they can't win. Whereas what happened in Belarus was they had the election, and the opposition did rather better than they've done in previous elections, but they still only got 10%. It might be, if they had a fairer go, they'd about double that and got 20%. Let's be generous. And then a younger generation were definitely encouraged to go out and protest against it. And of course, for young people, he's just an old guy. What the hell's he doing there? You know, you can imagine, you know. And then the police, very stupidly, beat everybody up on social media. And so all the friends of the people who were beaten up then came out to protest, and on it went. And if you see what happened last Sunday in Minsk, quite a big demonstration, but it's not big enough to overthrow the government. And the police just blocked the way to the presidential palace. And I think what they're going to do now is people will carry on protesting. But he's not, you know, basically, but what the West has got to recognise is that Lukashenko won the election. That's just fairly obvious. And you can huff and you can puff and say it wasn't fair. And what from the point of view of the West, he's just, why is he still there? They've still got collective farms, state-owned factories, full employment. There's no unemployment in Belarus.
It's a fairly successful country. Anyway, let's get on to talk about 9/11 now. We've got Ian Henshaw with us. Thank you very much, Ian, for coming up to Bristol to be with us today. We're going to start by having a listen to a guy called Richard Clark, and it'd be interesting if you could, first of all, tell us a little bit about your first you know, when did you put pen to paper and start writing about 9/11? Because, I mean, I love the books. They're very, very simple. They're very clear. And actually, there's almost all the information you need in there to just understand. And this is what this is all about. Understanding that the official story we were sold back in 2001 was a pup.
Yeah, well, that's true. Who actually did 9/11 is, you know, I would say pretty much unknown. I mean, you said it was evidence pointing to Israel. I personally don't see much evidence pointing to Israel. I think it's a bit like peeling an onion. You don't really know what you're going to find in the middle when you start peeling off the layers. And the two layers that are peeling off very badly from the point of view of the American establishment are basically the, The two layers are, first of all, the CIA's role and the FBI's role in facilitating a path for the alleged hijackers. And the other issue is, I'm so sorry, Martin, I've,
Martin. Okay, can we just, because you did mention the Israeli, you mentioned the Israeli angle there. I mean, we've covered quite a lot of times. There's a terrific article out there called 9/11, Israel Did It. It's on the WikiSpooks site. And it does go into quite a lot of detail about the key Zionist network assets, you know, things like World Trade Center security, airport security, and where Israeli firms were involved at some key points during the 9/11 attacks. So, Martin, can we just, before we move on, I mean, this is almost, we should be covering this at the end, but what, you know, what do you make of the whodunit question about 9/11 before we get into some of the details?
Well, I think Ian's being absolutely right there, because it's more important, really, to show that their story is wrong.
Yeah.
Questions of who done it, we can enter into. I'm perfectly happy to discuss who done it. We've got very, I mean, obviously, if we were police officers, we'd have suspicions of who done it. But the most important thing people need to get is that the official story is just impossible. It's similar to what we were talking about, the logical impossibilities in the Skripal case and all the rest
of it. Okay, well, I think it's quite... I quite like the idea of setting out right at the very beginning this possibility, and that's no more than that, that it was the Israeli state behind it, listing a few people who put their name to that opinion. We've got Christopher Bolin. We've got a guy called Professor Anthony Hall, who I met through you, actually, Ian, who's a Canadian professor, written a book called Earth into Property, which is fantastic. Professor Keith Van Der Peel, Paul Craig Roberts, Rebecca Roth, Alan Sobroski, former head of studies, I think he was at the US Army War College, and the Reverend Stephen Sizer from Victoria Water in London. All these names, pretty much, these I think are fairly, you know, normal, sensible people that would say that. But let's put that to one side for a minute. Who done it? Let's get into some of the detail and start actually on 9/11 itself, on the actual day of the attacks. And here is a guy who's quite important. We're going to hear from now, a guy called Richard Clark. So can you just tell us a little bit about him before we hear from him?
Well, yeah. Richard Clark, in my opinion, is the most important 9/11 whistleblower. He was the head of counterterrorism at the White House at the time. So everything that the CIA was doing and the FBI were doing legally went through Richard Clark up to Condoleezza Rice and Dick Cheney and President Bush.
So obviously he's quite an interesting person to hear from.
He is an expert, you know.
He was right in the middle of it in the decision making on the day.
When he condemned the Bush administration 2 years later in public at the investigation into it, the Keen Commission, he was lauded throughout the world, you know, all the media, he was on the front pages. And then suddenly, when he said something that was not welcome, i.e. the CIA had played a hand in this, and I know because I was their boss, and I know what they didn't tell me and they should have told me, when he came out and said that, total silence. Nobody's interested.
These errors of omission are fascinating to me. I find where someone who is supposed to be being told is just not told the stuff. We had that back in the 1970s under the Wilson government, where the Secret Services decided Wilson was a British spy, so they supplied all of the
Russian spy.
Sorry?
It wasn't a British
spy. Sorry, a Russian spy, yeah. And so they supplied all the intelligence to a certain Mr. James Callaghan, who I think was Home Secretary at the time. So Callaghan, sitting around the cabinet table in the 70s, was far, far more in the loop than even was the Prime Minister. He was kept out of the loop. So that's why this sort of thing is so important. Richard Clarke wasn't being told. Anyway, let's have a listen to his account of what happened on 9/11 itself.
And we had what we thought was state-of-the-art high-tech. We had a wall with about 8 TV monitors. And I could hold a meeting from there, from the Situation Room. And so I had the Secretary of Defense and the CIA Director and the Deputy Secretary of State and FBI Director and everybody all in one meeting all day long. The beauty of that was they could stay in their command centers. And we ran the operation from there all day, and did things we had never done before. You know, like very early in the day, I said, "Let's ground all the aircraft," and the FAA director said, "Well, we've never done that. I'm not sure we can do that." And we said, "Well, try," and it worked. We got every aircraft down in about an hour. There were like 2,400 aircraft aloft. There were aircraft coming in from Europe, which we landed in Canada.
Yeah.
Aircraft coming in from the Pacific, which we either turned around or landed in Canada. It was a very intense day where we went to nuclear alert. The first time since 1973 that we went to DEFCON 3. We buttoned down the country pretty quickly. We closed all the borders, closed all the harbors, because we didn't know what was coming next. There were 4 aircraft that had been hijacked. We initially were told the number was 11. And we were told one of them was headed toward us, toward the White House. And I think probably one of them was either headed toward us or the Capitol. I'm not sure where it was going to go, one or the other. But it took a damn long time for us to get fighter aircraft over the city. Damn long time.
I watched them. I was in D.C., and I remember I was outside, and they swooped down, and I thought it was the enemy. I was face down in the, literally in a field in Washington.
I kept screaming all morning for CAP, for Combat Air Patrol cover, and finally when they got it, just to prove to me that they did it, they had 2 F-15s go right over the White House at about 100 feet right off the ground.
I saw them. Yeah. Right,
I heard them.
That was something. Yeah. What was going through your mind? Because you'd, in a career that had built to that point for you, you'd been thinking about this. Chase Ramzi Youssef.
I mean, we knew.
You knew it was Bin Laden.
I knew it was Bin Laden. I knew, you know, for maybe 9 months. From intelligence reporting, that Al-Qaeda was planning a major attack on the U.S. CIA told me it would be overseas, but I had no reason to believe them. With their track record, they're not always right.
Right.
So we knew there would be a major Al-Qaeda attack. What we didn't know was where, when, exactly. I thought it would be around the first week in July, off a couple of months. Where, when, or how? We did not know that they were going to hijack aircraft, obviously.
So that's Richard Clarke there. He also has come out with more stuff, hasn't he? And I think he even wrote a book about it, Ian.
Well, he did. He wrote a very good book, which raised a few doubts and had some interesting facts in it. For instance, he explained in his book that exercises can be really, really live. You know, they're not just like, you know, sort of putative things. They would even have a fake press conference at the end of an exercise if it was in something involving something that would be of political interest to the public. But it wasn't really until he started giving interviews years later that this full enormity of what he was saying came out. And basically, he says that the CIA were running the alleged 9/11 hijackers. They were running them with the help and support of the Saudi, and this is where I would you know, we might have a disagreement.
Well, that's it. No, it's interesting, though, that he's actually having a go at the CIA there on TV. He's saying, look, these guys, you can't trust.
Well, he was already beginning to suspect, I think, right from day one, how come the CIA never told me any inkling of this? These guys must... He would know, as a national security professional, that it's not that easy to infiltrate hijackers and, you know, fundamentalist hijackers, 15 of them, and have them living in America without anybody detecting them. And, of course, they had been detected. They'd been very thoroughly detected by the FBI, who was stymied by the CIA, even though the FBI were legally in charge in the United States, on United States territory. They were stymied by the CIA, who basically blocked the information. And there's an FBI guy on the CIA top secret Osama bin Laden unit who is furious about it, Mark Rossini. He says justice hasn't been done. They blocked the information. And there's something very, very dodgy. That's my words, those last ones. There's something very, very dodgy about all this. So, you know, there's no lack of whistleblowers any longer. And the reason I often emphasize this side of it when I'm interviewed, rather than the issue about the towers collapsing, which is the other side, of course, of the 9/11 issue, is because this is all paper trail stuff, which lawyers and people like that on. If you go to a lawyer and say, I don't think those towers collapsed, it was too suspicious, he's going to say, well, I'm a lawyer, you know, go and not speak to an architect about it. But of course, the country's run by lawyers, not by architects. So if you want to get to the establishment, I think it's better to go for the paper trail side, the people like Richard Clarke. Now, Richard Clarke is not saying the CIA organized 9/11 so as to, you know, but what he is saying is they've got an awful lot that they kept secret. They've got an awful lot of questions to answer. And obviously, people, it's unthinkable to him. He was friendly with all these people. They were his life, you know. And it's very difficult to come to face the fact that somebody you've known for all your life is a mass murderer. And I actually haven't had to do that myself, so I don't know who I'm... But you know what I mean. It's you can quite understand Richard Clarke, and also for tactical reasons, doesn't want to come out and say, you know, well, actually, the CIA organized 9/11. And then on the other hand, of course, you've got the FBI side of it, where FBI agents are speaking up, and there are court cases which are trying to force the FBI to release what it knows, the information it knows. The families of 9/11 victims, even the ones who aren't accusing the CIA of anything, they're still furious as well. And of course, we've got a family member in England who's just hoping to have his inquest reopened.
Okay, that's Matt Campbell.
That's right, Matt Campbell. He's a very brave, intelligent, and, you know, a really wonderful guy. I know him. I've become friendly with him since this started. And his brother, Jeff, you know, they found his head. Matt is, you know, he's been through a lot. And he's now, they're trying to raise money to reopen the inquest, which, of course, took place in the UK. So it could be, you know, it's theoretically possible that the UK will lead, you know, the opening up of the 9/11 issue, but it's very unlikely.
Well, one of the most incredible bald-faced lies about the whole thing is that we've got, you know, the Saudi Arabians really at the heart of this. All these hijackers are Saudis. Now, there's this rather tense relationship, isn't there, between Donald Trump and Saudi Arabia with these various threats to release large areas of up till now hidden reports about Saudi involvement.
Well, I don't think there's much doubt that the Saudis... I was talking about peeling an onion. I mean, one of the layers of that onion is the Saudi involvement. But the Saudis have always sort of like done the dirty work, because... See, what happens with Saudi Arabia is if you expose them, as has been done really over 9/11, and I can tell you why if we've got time, they just say, well, you know, what do you expect? The Saudis, you know, primitive country, we can't do anything about it. We depend on them for oil. So, you know, in the national interest, we're not going to look that way. Even though we're going to invade Afghanistan, we're going to destroy Iraq, we're not going to look at Saudi Arabia, who actually supplied 15 of the hijackers. And... of course, John Brennan, now this is an interesting, you heard this first here, Tony. John Brennan, who has been leading the attacks on President Trump, coordinating them, ex-head of the CIA, promoted by Obama, that nice Mr. Obama, He was actually the CIA station chief in Riyadh in the years leading up to 9/11. So that guy, who was at the very heart of Saudi-US relations, is now running the campaign against Trump, who's threatened to reveal things about 9/11. Now, I personally don't believe Trump. I think he's just a con man. But, you know, a lot of people do still trust him and believe him. And, you know, it must be very frightening if you were helping to organize 9/11 to see Trump in the White House in the position, as I was saying earlier, you know, with accountable democracy. The only person who can achieve, you know, a righteous outcome is the President of the United States.
Well, there's another chap as well who was very much involved in 9/11, whose name we've been hearing recently, and that's a guy called Robert Mueller.
Mueller.
He apparently played a significant role in covering up the Saudi and the British role in the 9/11 attacks, wholesale destruction of the US Constitution, which followed in its wake. That is, things like the intelligence services being put in charge of Homeland Security, this sort of thing. So what was Robert Mueller's role? Because we know him as the FBI chief prosecutor of Donald Trump, various prosecutions that went nowhere and attempts at impeachment. But where was he on 9/11? What was he up
well,
to?
Well, I think Mueller had only just moved into the FBI at that point. I think he's just a sort of, you know, safe pair of hands.
But he's one of these people who... he's involved in this cover-up on the 9/11, and then he has this amazing astronomical rise right up to the top of the FBI.
Well, he was the head of the FBI. I'd have to check this. It's so long ago now, but I think you'll find he was the head of the... he'd just been parachuted in as head of the FBI just before 9/11. And he, funnily enough, he actually gave quite a valuable quote to 9/11 skeptics. He said, I'm paraphrasing him here. He said, "It's very surprising that in all our investigations into 9/11, we never ever found a paper trail leading back to Osama bin Laden." So actually Mueller, you know, he's hedging his bets a bit. You know, he's putting in a bit to ingratiate himself if the truth ever comes out. He can say, look, he said that. But at the same time, you know, he's not into making trouble for himself, and he didn't get to where he was by making trouble for anybody, that's for sure, as with so many bureaucrats in Washington. But I personally think Brennan's a more interesting character.
Martin?
Well, I'm just listening to what's being said. I mean, all of the detail that Ian is on top of, I tend to just go for basic stuff which I can understand.
We heard a bit there about the non-appearance of the Air Force, didn't we?
Well, indeed, yeah. Yes. Yeah. I mean, there's a simple question. Where was the United States Air Force?
I'm calling for combat air patrol, but it didn't appear.
Yeah. Well, we know what happened. There was an exercise of an attack over the North Pole by the Russians, and they were all been taken off out of the United States and sent to Canada. That's why there's hardly any planes there. Again, very suspicious.
There was some at the Andrews Air Base, yes, which were never...
Well, indeed, yeah. And also, of course, as Condoleezza Rice said, who could have imagined that people would fly planes into buildings?
Of course, anybody could have imagined it.
And in any case, they were actually carrying out an exercise on that day of planes flying into buildings,
yes,
I understand.
Absolutely.
And therefore, some people were saying, is this real or is this the exercise?
Well, my personal interest was exactly what did happen, and they're on record saying that. And, you know, if you ask me, we're all talking about, you know, our little pet theories about who really lay deeply behind it. I think you're going to find that it was...
Come on. Who was behind it? Come on.
Oh, no, he's not going to tell us now.
Spit it out, Ian.
Well, I think you're going to find it was basically the American military-industrial complex. And the reason I resist accusations against Israel is Israel might do something like that. They might think of it. But, you know, what a risk to take. You know, why not get people in America to do it? You know, people who can protect themselves in the future.
Some people, real big winners, take big risks, don't they?
Can I just say, yeah, the linkages between the military-industrial complex in the US, the British military and the Israeli military, They're almost, one organisation.
Yeah, I know.
It's like saying the difference between the UDA and the UVF.
Oh, one of the things that you quite often hear from writers like George Monbiot, for example, in The Guardian, is that, you know, well, why is there that nobody's blown the whistle on this? Well, actually, there's quite a few people have blown the whistle, and one of them we're going to hear from now is a chap called Philip Marshall, who wrote a book called The Big Bamboozle and The War on Terror. He's a former airline pilot, and he was very outspoken about all of this, and unfortunately died not long after he published his book in horrific circumstances. I think his children as well were murdered. Some
and
gunman,
the dog.
A gunman came into his home. So tell us a little bit about Philip Marshall, Ian.
Well, he came from nowhere, you know. He was typical of the 9/11 truth movement. He was somebody who believed the official story, because you do, you know. And he eventually started looking at the details. I can't remember what prompted him. And he realised that he'd had dealings with the CIA for other periods of his life. And he realised that actually, you know, this story wasn't true. And he looked into it, and he decided that his particular scenario was that he thought that they'd trained the Saudi hijackers, and they really were flying the planes into the buildings. Now, a lot of people don't believe that. A lot of people think they were run on autopilot, because it would have been too difficult for people with those skill levels to do that.
So it's Executive Intelligence Review, LaRouche, have an article, Was It Murder? Philip Marshall, author of The Big Bamboozle, is dead, published on the 15th of March 2013.
Yeah.
A veteran airline pilot published The Big Bamboozle, they say, 9/11 and the War on Terror, which documents the role of Saudi Arabia in running, so there's another culprit potentially, September the 11th attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, and of the Bush presidency in facilitating it by standing down the Air Force. 1 year later, on February the 2nd, 2013, after the book was published, Marshall was found dead along with his two teenage children and his dog in his home in California. Anyway, let's have a listen now to the great, the wonderful Philip Marshall talking about what he called the Big Bamboozle.
They had all these reports, supposedly, that went up to the White House, and those reports kept saying that, oh, this guy Bin Laden's getting ready to strike. But, you know, as an airline captain at that time, no one told me there was a threat out there. No one told Jason Dahl or anybody else that these threats were out there. So I thought it was really interesting. And when I looked into the evidence on Bin Laden, you know, through the congressional inquiry, who looked into it for a long time, almost a year, there's no operational evidence at all on Bin Laden. They have 80 pages worth on the Saudi intelligence.
On the cover of your book is the seal of the intelligence community. Why is that seal there?
It mentioned the intelligence community a lot. You hear it a lot on the media, but you really don't know what it is. And I started picking up that whoever this intelligence community was, they were the ones in the reports that kept saying, oh, the intelligence community says that Bin Laden is behind 9/11 because, and then there was nothing after the because, really, except for that he wrote a fatwa back in 1998. So that's the only evidence that's cited anywhere, is that he wrote a fatwa that he was going to strike the United States. So I started looking in, okay, so who is the intelligence community? We present this evidence of who the intelligence community is. They're every armed authority of the United States as a result of 9/11, as a result of the attack. They control the Department of Homeland Security, the TSA, the CIA, the FBI, the energy. And the big one is the United States Treasury. They have learned how to go around our Congress and tap directly into the Treasury. And those are our tax dollars that are sitting there as the grand prize for anyone that has taken over the United States government, is that they get to the Treasury. And they control the Treasury. I think from now on, anyone who reads this book will know the rest of their life, when they hear in the intelligence community, what exactly that is. And it's being run from a 1.4 million square foot building called the George Bush Center of Intelligence, right outside of Washington. So the way I see it is that they have overpowered our government. They have overpowered the three branches of equal power with scare tactics. We got to throw all of our money at terrorism. So $15 trillion has disappeared since the time that George W. Bush took over. They spent every penny that we've sent them in our taxes, and then $15 trillion on top of that. So I'm wondering, where did all that money go, and who's controlling that money? It's a pattern that I was studying before that. The BCCI scandal was very fishy type. They got into the Treasury, and billions of dollars disappear almost on a daily basis for the last 10 years.
And, of course, you know, the one thing, he wasn't very articulate, but he did miss out one power center, of course. I would say the most important, actually, and that is the media, the Washington media. I mean, they are the CIA, you know, they sort of almost are the CIA.
Well, in fact, we know, don't we, about Operation Mockingbird going on for many, many decades, where it started off with just a spy in every newsroom, going on to actually controlling the editorial policy of every major media outlet in the country.
Yeah, and we had that German journalist explaining how, I forget his name.
Rudolf Urquhart.
Yeah, explaining how exactly the same thing happens in Germany.
By the way, this book is just out in English, isn't it, recently?
Is it? Yes, yeah. Yes, it will have been. Yeah, Progressive Press, I think, published it, didn't they?
Yeah, so all these various agencies, he's saying basically, Martin there is, I think, brilliant, articulate guy. There he is speaking, what, 7 years ago or so, 8 years ago, before someone came into his house and murdered him, the rest of his family and his dog. Whoever that was.
And just in case anybody thought it was the official story was true that he committed suicide, the local police refused to call, you know, the behaviour of the local police and the local prosecutors was evidence in itself, if not proof, that his death was highly suspicious.
How? What did they do?
They refused to investigate. They just obstructed.
Okay, so this case is hands off. Someone gave him a call.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Yeah.
No, don't touch it, please.
They wouldn't. And they got quite threatening when some of the
Martin,
neighbours...
Martin, the interesting thing about him is a little bit like Robin Cook, in fact. He's extremely articulate. And this is, I think, in some ways, what the dark side fear the most. Somebody like him, he's a airline professional pilot, written a book, and not only that, he's incredibly articulate there in explaining... This is the real problem. Somebody has gone round the whole governmental process and they're now running things behind the scenes, whether it's the judiciary, the legislature or the president. You may as well forget it because they're controlling all of them.
Yeah, well, he's an interesting character, obviously, but he hasn't got inside knowledge as such. He's basically somebody who's an outsider.
To a certain extent, I mean, he's had dealings with the CIA in the past.
Yes,
apparently.
He's had dealings with the CIA and he's an airline pilot, and therefore he is a... You know, and especially
I wouldn't
if
say all airline pilots have had dealings with.
No,
the
no,
CIA.
But I mean, if he wants to shout his mouth off, he's definitely going to be a target potentially, isn't he?
Well, in which case, he's rather a brave guy.
Well, indeed, and of course, we've also. Let's mention here William Rodriguez, who is the janitor in the World Trade Center, and he came over here some years ago. We'll all remember. Telling his story of what happened
at
on the
Bristol,
day.
Yeah,
what happened on the day, and you know. He said there were definitely bombs in the building. And, of course, Donald Trump said, soon after the events, those buildings were definitely bombed. I build buildings like that for a living. And though the airplanes can't just crash into buildings and make them crash like that, the buildings were definitely bombed.
Not so sure
bombed.
About your New York accent.
Well, all right. But anyway. But I think as people go to the polls in the US, they ought to dig that up and listen to what he's saying. Because, of course, Trump, being a chump, is just coming out with the obvious. Buildings like that do not collapse. And we're obviously going to come to that in a moment, but we're still dealing with, you know, what you might call the paper trail. But, you know, there's some pretty obvious stuff which just doesn't add up.
Anyway, for me, the big hiatus for me was watching a video called 9/11 in Plain Sight, which I think was, it must have been around about beginning of 2003, so that's about 18 months or 2 years after the 9/11 attacks, which really used video evidence from the day itself, Ian, really to show, well, hang on, this and this does not, you know, one among doesn't make two here. It is not actually adding up at all. So there is all sorts of evidence in those videos which showed. I mean, one of the basic things was to do with the firefighters on the day were saying in that film, it was just there were explosives in the buildings, effectively. So this is another side of this, isn't it? More people are now coming out and saying there are explosives in the buildings, folks. So who put those there? Was it Bin Laden?
Well, exactly. One of the developments, you know, in the sort of research side in the last year is that some very energetic researchers have gone through all the cuttings, you know, all the information bases, and they've found 36 reliable people, like, so not just like the kid round the block, but, you know, professional journalists, etc., who all went on record saying that there were explosions. I mean, it looked like an explosion. It was called an explosion by perhaps most of the people who saw it. But the official story, of course, couldn't allow that because it would be not, wouldn't be credible that a bomb.
The thing is, you can see it in the films of the collapse of the World Trade Center and Building 7. It's, you know, there's these little explosions coming out one by one, controlled demolition.
That's right. And you've got, for instance, the things flying out. I think what's more difficult to explain, you can come up with explanations, for, you know, for some of these phenomena. But the one that I think they've got the most trouble with is where you see very, very heavy beams flying horizontally at high speed. Now, you know, anybody out there who's got O-level physics, GCSE physics or above, will know, have heard about conservation of momentum.
Well, so was there any evidence of explosives in the actual wreckage afterwards?
Well, yes, there was, but most of it was sent to Japan for recycling.
It was very quickly tidied up, wasn't
it? Yeah, very quickly, yeah.
Let's get rid of the evidence, guys.
But actually, you know, once again, we were discussing this with the paper trail. It's there on the paper trail. You know, the official investigation, the first official investigation, they found vaporized steel. They found signs of vaporization of the steel. Now, you know, could that be caused by just a building collapse? Vaporization is quite a lot to happen to steel, you know. And so that was never explained.
Surely but surely this has been unravelling, hasn't it? It was maybe only for really a few months, maybe a year, a couple of years, that people really believed that story. And now, slowly but surely, it's unravelled. It's almost, but it's too late for it to unravel. It doesn't really matter anymore because the war on terror started. It's happened. It's rolling. It's
job.
Running.
Now they've got COVID.
Yeah, so what's the point in looking into this now still?
Well, because it's, I think it is worth setting the record straight. You know, in future, people need to see the precedent. If you know, because the criminals, they have a much more short-term outlook. They just want to get lots of money and not get caught. So they don't really care as much.
The same as the City of London, funnily.
Well, in this culture, who doesn't? But the criminals don't have that much of a long-term perspective. And it's easier to get them 20 years late.
Anyway, I mentioned the video in plain sight, the documentary. I think it was about half an hour long. I looked at it and I thought, right, okay, so my suspicions are confirmed here. This really does need to be properly unravelled. I was a little bit slow. Martin, you were a bit quicker, weren't you? I think it was almost on the day you got stuck in.
Yeah, well, the first thing I noticed was that I realised immediately that this was some kind of false flag attack. And I then started using the internet. So up to that point, I hardly used the internet.
What did you actually do?
I just went on the internet for the first time, and the first thing I discovered, because I knew what I was looking for, was that John O'Neill, the former deputy director of the FBI, had given a press conference in July with Boris Ardandeski, who were ex-French intelligence agents, saying that Bush was protecting bin Laden. And that was already out there. So I just turned it into a leaflet, and I went to a seminar at the LSE about 2 or 3 weeks after the attack, where Mort Dworkin III, political attaché at the US Embassy, was debating with Peter Gowan, who is an old friend of mine, about the future of US power. And I handed out leaflets about it at that event.
Did he notice you?
Well, no, he's
at the front.
I had a run-in with him at the end. Now, the point...
So did you actually speak at the meeting?
Yes, I tried to speak. I had to pay £25 to get in, but I couldn't get a word in edgeways, because you can imagine there's an awful lot of windbags who want to talk about the future of American power.
Oh, God.
Everybody's an expert on that sort of thing, especially when they pay £25 to get in there. So I knew immediately there was a problem, and the first thing I picked up was that. But of course, I then started looking at other things.
So did you actually get to talk to him in the meeting?
Yes. Not in the meeting.
Did you make the point?
I stood up in the meeting with a little sign saying, question, why did the FBI man resign? Answer, because Bush was protecting bin Laden. And the security grabbed hold of me, because it was in the LSE, and hustled me off, because the problem for the LSE is if they invite the US embassy to come and speak at things and then people protest them in the meetings, they're not going to come again. And so the security just took me out to the front. I said, okay, I'm going.
Well, the political attaché at the US embassy won't come on this
program. Anyway, so I went out and I got a little leaflet about it, which I'd run up, you know, and I directed people to the book. I didn't know at that stage that John O'Neill had died in the Twin Towers.
Yeah.
I thought he was still alive. But, of course, he actually took over as head of security in the Twin Towers on the day of the attack. And he died in the attack.
He may have been killed, actually.
Well, some people have suggested that they didn't just leave it to chance, that they went round to his office before the attack came in and made sure that he wasn't going to escape. But anyway, I didn't know that at the time. All I knew is he'd written this book. It was a book in French at that stage. Anyway, so I handed the leaflets out, and I was had chats with various people. Bonnie Greer was there, if you know her. So I had a chat with her, and then I was basically getting bored. I was about an hour and a half, and I thought he must have gone out the back way.
So you were hanging around.
I was hanging around,
waiting for him to come out.
But then it turned out that there was no back way, but he'd been waiting inside because he didn't want to come out. Because I was allowed to stand on the... I said to the security, can I stand here? This isn't LSE property. He said, yes, fine. As long as it's not on the property, you're okay. So anyway, he eventually came out, and I went up to him and I said, you do know that the deputy director of the FBI resigned in July because he said Bush was protecting bin Laden. And he said to me, yeah, John O'Neill, we know. And I said, well, we know too, matey, and don't you forget it. And I just walked away at that point. And that's how that went.
Thank you. Nice little story, Martin. Now we're going to go to Dave von Kleist, who is the producer of the 9/11 in Plain Sight documentary, because he's not one to mince words. And here he is talking about the immediate reaction by the dark side and by people who don't like to think these things through to this whole idea of, oh, they're just a bunch of conspiracy theorists.
The immediate knee-jerk reaction most people will have when this topic is discussed is that people, those of you that are fixated on this 9/11 issue, are a bunch of conspiracy theorists. So with that in mind, let's look at the definition of conspiracy theory. I mean, that's the word conspiracy. If you play word association and ask somebody to think of the first word that you can think of after you hear the word conspiracy, most people will say theory. And that's because we've all been trained to associate theory with conspiracy. So in other words, no conspiracies are real. They're all just theories. So let's define what is a conspiracy theory. Conspiracy, by definition, is when two or more people plan something in secret. All right. Theory, by definition, is a supposition, a concept, an idea. For example, in theory, if I purchase a raffle ticket, I can win a prize. Now, once I purchase a raffle ticket, it's no longer a theory. It becomes a possibility. And the more raffle tickets that I purchase, the more possible and eventually probable the win becomes. And such is the case with a conspiracy theory. When you have no evidence to support the contention of a conspiracy, then indeed it is a conspiracy theory. But once you have a piece of evidence, no matter how flimsy or circumstantial it may be, the idea of a conspiracy becomes a possibility. And the more evidence that you amass to support the contention of a conspiracy, the more probable and eventually likely that conspiracy is. So if you apply that towards the official story, I remember that on September 18th, a week after the attacks on September 11th, Condoleezza Rice did a news conference, and she stated, and I'm paraphrasing, I might be quoting her word for word, she said, "We have definitive proof and evidence that links Osama bin Laden to the attacks on September 11th, and we will release this information in due time." Now, to this day, there has never been any information released or any evidence that proves or links Osama bin Laden to the September 11th attacks. So if you apply the official story to the term conspiracy theory, they charged Osama bin Laden with a conspiracy to destroy the Twin Towers and to attack America. However, they never provided any evidence to support that contention. So by definition, that means that the official story is a conspiracy theory because they never provided any evidence to support it.
Well, that's Dave Von Kleist, who lost his radio show over in the United States. I think he was on the GCN network or somewhere like that. Unfortunately, some of the most clear thinkers seem to be censored in this whole world. But what do you make of that, Ian? He's making a pretty convincing argument there that the official story is actually a conspiracy theory, so everybody else is probably closer to the truth.
Yeah, well, I mean, I obviously, you know, that's what they try to smear us with. So, you know, one gives it a bit of thought. Nowadays, I don't give it so much thought. I just think, oh, well, that just shows that they haven't got anything better to say. A bit like Boris Johnson in Parliament today, smearing, you know, the Labour leader. And also, I would have to just mention that, because they'll bring this up, you know, that Osama bin Laden was quite happy to see it happen. And there's some evidence that he tried to take credit for it afterwards in videos, which are disputed. Some people say they're false. Some people say, no, they're not all false. One or two of them are genuine. And he made a lot of radio broadcasts. I think what happened was that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed organized it. And as the, you know, the independent newspapers said, he was actually a Pakistani ISI agent. And he was a very good organizer. And, the 9/11 commission found that he was not actually one of Osama bin Laden's closest friends at all. He just foisted himself. So he seems to be the key guy. And that's why I've predicted for years now, he'll never be brought to trial.
Well, what about to the dancing Israelis, for example? What were they doing there? Are they organised by Khalid Sheikh Mohammed?
Well, the problem with the dancing Israelis is that nobody's actually proved that they were there before the events happened. And if you could prove that, and it's been stated...
they were filming the event.
No.
Martin?
They were arrested, and they went on television in Israel saying, we are Mossad agents, and we were filming the first attack because we were documenting it.
No,
they're on the record
they
of saying
didn't
that.
Say, they never said we. There's no evidence that they were there on the roof with their filming before the first plane hit. That's what you need to prove, that they had foreknowledge. Anybody can run up to the roof afterwards.
Well,
after
no,
the
but the woman who saw them said that when the first plane hit the building, they were on the roof of a car, and that they started lighting lighters and doing high fives. So that she then took the number of the car, gave it to the police, and later in the day they were arrested.
Yeah, but I dispute what you're saying about that she saw them on the roof before the first plane hit. That's obviously
they claimed what she said. Israeli television claimed, when they were on Israeli television, they claimed they were in New York City that morning to document the event. That's what they claimed on the Israeli TV.
They were speaking in Hebrew, which most people don't understand. I don't understand. But the best translation I've seen says that they went up to the roof to document the event. That's a translation from Hebrew, so it's not terribly reliable as to its exact nuance. The question is there any, when they seize their footage, was there any pictures of the tower before the plane hit it? And there wasn't.
Good question. Anyway, finally on 9/11...
I mean, I'm sorry, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that Israel's definitely had no part in this at all.
No, fine.
But it's important not to jump to conclusions, especially when you're dealing with such a powerful lobby.
Okay. Aaron Russo, he was a Hollywood film director, who had all sorts to say about the September the 11th attacks, and I think it's well worth having listened to his comments now. He's another one, like Philip Marshall, who's passed away since.
By creating 9/11, an event to terrify the American people that were being attacked by terrorists, you create a world where there's an enemy that can never be pinpointed. You can never win the battle. It's a 100-year war. It's a never-ending war on terrorism, right? So you're always fighting this war. And through 9/11, which is the first lie, then you create the war on terrorism, which is the next lie. Then you create the war on Iraq for weapons of mass destruction, which is the next lie. And it's one lie to the next lie to the next lie. Now it's going to be Iran, the next lie, sending more troops and a surge into Iraq. It's just one thing leading to the other. It's always in the point of taking over more countries, more dominance, you know, making sure the American dollar, making sure the G8 stays in control of everything. And what they want to do is to control the American people, control the people of the world, put RFID chips in everybody, so everybody's a slave to these central banks.
So that's the voice of a US film producer, Aaron Russo, who got very friendly with a guy called Nick Rockefeller for a while. And Nick Rockefeller apparently told him about all these sorts of things, but then he decided he'd go public and blow the whistle about it. He was not happy at all. Aaron Russo's take on it, though, is, I think, something that many people understand now, Ian, which is that this whole war on terror was just an excuse for the US to go and do what effectively what Nazi Germany was doing, just invading whoever they wanted to.
Yeah, and I think that's right. And the transparency of the lies, the simplistic, I think what strikes me often, and don't ask me for an example, you know, but what strikes me is that it's just so flagrant and so casual and so obviously not true if you're sceptical. It's a bit like they're saying, well, we don't care about you. You know, we're going to tell our loyal followers, the people who do well out of the system. There's still 30%, 40% who do quite well out of the system here in the UK. Might be less than that after the next recession. But, you know, really what they're doing is just a tribal call to arms, isn't it? With the lies as a sort of very thin, you know, reason to... They wouldn't really convince anybody neutral.
So anyway, we're going to hear now, finally on 9/11, from Scott Bennett. He's a former US psychological warfare officer. He was put in jail for speaking out about various things over in the US, and now he's writing about all these sorts of things. I mean, one of the most fascinating things that Scott revealed was that Al-Qaeda, the Free Syrian Army and ISIS, these kind of organizations, these mercenary groups, which were funded by foreigners in Syria trying to cause a Syrian civil war, proxy armies effectively were being funded through Swiss banks, and he was investigating that when he was working for the US authorities, and then he was put in jail. But anyway, Scott has some, I thought, quite interesting things to say when I spoke to him last week about the 9/11 being actually a precursor for what we're seeing now with this kind of COVID psychological warfare.
I don't think we would have had COVID-19 had we not had the psychological operation of September 11th. That September 11th should go down in history as the greatest crime against humanity ever committed, and it was committed by the United States, the CIA, the Mossad, the Saudis, the Israelis, the Bush administration, and Dick Cheney, and Condoleezza Rice, and General Dick Myers, and Donald Rumsfeld, and Dov Zakheim, who was my boss at Booz Allen Hamilton. All of these people should be charged for war crimes for the September 11th attacks. And you're exactly right. The physical scientific evidence is overwhelming that it was false. It was artificially designed, that Building 7 fell into its own footprint. I was personally at the Pentagon the next day. There was no plane anywhere. There was no wheels. There was no luggage. There was no massive engines, nothing. It was just a big hole with a tarp covering it. And allegedly a missile had hit that. Now, every American who's worn the uniform since then should be charged with treason and executed if they do not stand on the side of the Constitution and come down on the right side of history that says this was a false flag attempt to manipulate America into war. You wear the uniform and swear an oath to the Constitution to protect it against all enemies, foreign and domestic, and that means we protect our country against lies and liars who position us, who feed us lies to position us for war. That's exactly what was done. The seven countries in 5 years, the Odin Annan plan by Netanyahu. Netanyahu came to Congress and lied and said Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. You need to go to war. And that's precisely what happened. It all precipitated the 9/11 attacks. We've written a book on that. Robert David Steele and myself and other authors, and people can get it at shellgamewhistleblower.com. All of this precipitated the COVID-19 psyop. And the COVID-19 is conveniently happening just at the turn of another decade. So it's around the 10-year term when they pop one of these off, and this is the scary virus, the invisible, the death angel hovering over people's homes, so you better stay inside and wear your mask. I think it's trying to break down society. I think also it's created a certain level of animosity and anxiousness, and we see that in some of the civil war disruptions and the protestations and the burning down of cities in America and elsewhere. But all of this was started in 2001, and we always have to come on the side of truth and separate ourselves from the lies. We have to come down on the side that, and I think Donald Trump is hopefully going to move in that direction, that endless wars and these things that have precipitated 9/11 are crimes, and they need to be exposed, and these wars need to be stopped. And the virus medical vaccine complex needs to be rejected entirely. And, you know, people need to really kind of wake up and do their own research. And I'm glad they have your show as one of the voices of truth, Tony, that they can tap into.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily. We're hopefully one of the voices of truth. It's very nice of him to say that, isn't it? But at the end of the day there, he's saying he's definitely not going to have any vaccines. But he sees this as almost like the dark forces, if we can call them that, seem to like to be able to define the decade at the beginning of the decade. He's linking the defining of the century, the 21st century, or 9/11, to something else going on now. But what do you make of what he had to say about 9/11 there?
Well, I couldn't help noticing that phrase, against all enemies, because, of course, Richard Clarke's book was called Against All Enemies. So, you know, if there couldn't be better evidence that Richard Clarke is on the right side.
Scott Bennett also talked about, he thinks that the COVID psyop, as he calls it, has been a bit of a blunder.
They've grossly overstepped their bounds. This is a push towards fascism and a testing to see how people respond. Megan Whitmer of Michigan, shutting down football, shutting down churches, arresting people who go into congregations and these sort of things. The same thing being done in New Jersey by Murphy, the governor, who shuts down a gym and throws the men in court and tries to imprison them for opening their gym. The attorney generals and the attorneys that prosecute hairdressers who have to work to feed their children, they're thrown in jail and go through the court system. This is what revolutions are made of. This is the substance of civil wars. This is the ignition for both revolutions and renaissance. And I think I would like to think that we're on the verge of a renaissance, because there are more intelligent people who value their freedom and their independence and have critical thinking and go, you know what? I have not been sick. My family hasn't been sick. If I did catch a flu, maybe I took propolis, oregano oil, vitamin C, and maybe hydroxychloroquine if it was serious, but I'm not losing my teeth or going blind or melting into a zombie. So this claim of otherwise is all propaganda.
As the former psychological warfare officer for the US Army, Scott Bennett there. The interesting angle he's got, Martin, here, I think, on this case, is that they may have just pushed this one too far. And actually, what may come out of this is some kind of renaissance, something positive, as people kick back against the lies.
Well, I think we've got to distinguish between COVID and 9/11. We were talking about 9/11.
He's talking about COVID.
No, he's coming and talking about COVID. So we're coming back to talk about COVID. Let's come back to my views on COVID. I think it's a biological warfare attack on the Chinese Communist Party, which has been allowed to flow back over the United States of America to cover up the second bailout. You mentioned 2001 there and the decade. The other thing that's happened in 2008, the banking system collapsed. And at that point, capitalism...
But we're getting away from the point here. What about this idea that maybe they pushed it too far?
Well, they've pushed it too far because the Chinese jumped on the biological warfare attack, and they've had a tenth of the deaths that we've had in this country. And because they treated it as a biological warfare attack, they've managed to keep it out. And all of their ships and planes, for example, are COVID free. And as they go to war in the South China Sea, they're going to find it's quite difficult.
I've got a little bit of a personal anecdote here. Because a few months ago, you know, a few weeks ago, they started saying, oh, well, this is the Chinese flu, you know, let's blame the Chinese for that. And at that point, I was contacted again by our wonderful friends in the mainstream media from The Times. I got this rather nasty email. It popped into my interest saying, I'm planning to write about you in the Sunday Times. I believe you've been undermining morale in the fight against COVID. That was because of my statements on TV that I didn't think it was
so
serious.
Which journalist was that?
I'm not going to dignify him with a name.
Oh, that's a shame. We can know to put him on our block list.
Yeah.
What
had upset them was this issue about how it started. And I'd said on an alternative radio show, Kevin Barrett's show, that if the CIA were going to start accusing the Chinese of creating this, then it was probably more plausible that, as Martin says, I'm not saying this is plausible, but it would be more plausible, that if anything, the CIA planted it on China. And that really upset the Sunday Times. They went to the trouble of, hounding me and trying to get me to rescind what I was saying.
The Sunday Times, of course, is owned by Rupert Murdoch. And, of course, the Murdoch press in Australia went big on this. They said they got inside information that, in fact, it was leaked from the Wuhan laboratory. Steve Bannon, who's now under arrest for something else, said, and we've got an insider who will tell us that the Chinese deliberately did this and this. So they came out with the thing that this is a biological warfare attack by China. But, of course, why would China do it on themselves?
Yes.
And, of course, they wouldn't. Mm. But, of course, I'm quite sure the Chinese intelligence services are thinking about exactly the same
thing. So why is Murdoch weighed in so hard on this, then, do you think?
Well, because Murdoch was one of the owners of... Do you remember the World Trade Center was privatized some weeks before the attack? And it was Larry Silverstein who bought it. And Murdoch is in business with Silverstein.
I think he's in it, an oil firm over.
That's
in,
right.
Levant.
Yeah, in the Golan Heights, there's the Genie Oil, which is going. There's a load of oil in the Golan.
So they're
Heights.
Mates, basically.
Yeah, I mean Murdoch is
business friends.
If we're looking as police officers or revenging terrorists, the list of people who are involved, it's Silverstein. Yeah, because he was the one who made the decision to blow WTC7. Yeah, and of course they made a massive fortune on the insurance.
So we're doing quite a lot of joining.
Anybody in the elite has got, because like I was saying earlier about
Giuliani,
basic human psychology. Anybody in America in the elites knows instinctively the truth, which is that if you can blame a foreign enemy, it takes the heat off you.
I think we've done quite a good job there in opening up a little bit of a few clues about the international mafia and the real criminals behind 9/11. But look, one of the things I really like to, before we have our final item, which is about the Rosicrucians, this week there's been a quite extraordinary video being put out by Elon Musk. And Elon Musk is one of those Bilderberg characters who's very much into the whole idea of transhumanism, the idea that human beings are here to genetically modify themselves to become actually whatever they wish to be. They're also rather into the idea that, if you pay enough money, you should be able to have a child that lives forever. Mm. All these kinds of things, like, for example, hooking into from the digital world of computers straight into the human brain. Well, anyway, Elon Musk is revealing this week his latest moves to do this.
Can I just mention one thing before we move away from 9/11? There's a leafleting outside the BBC on the anniversary, the 19-year anniversary, which falls at the end of this week.
Okay, so where is the BBC week? In London? Shepherd's Bush?
Portland Place.
Oh, right, so
yeah,
the
main
BBC radio.
The
radio place just by Oxford Circus.
Oxford Circus, yeah.
Okay,
and it's there on Reinvestigate
9/11
website. 3:00 in the afternoon.
Okay, so
and we're going to be there for about 3 hours.
Would like to go and meet Ian?
Yeah, I'll be there.
Do you go to the pub afterwards or anything like that?
We used to. I'm not quite sure what we're going to do this time.
I think you should, if you're allowed to.
Not if there's more than 50 people.
Maybe
surely.
We'll crack open a few cans of Tennent's
Lager. I think if you've got more
lager.
Than 50 people, you need to go to two pubs at least anyway. Anyway, so let's have a listen to this thing about the Neuralink from Elon Musk this week, which is a pretty extraordinary idea. What he wants to do is saw a little hole in your brain, put a kind of coin-shaped thing in your brain, use a bit of superglue to stick it there, using a robot. So he wants to be able to sort of plug, basically, a kind of Wi-Fi thing straight into your brain. Elon Musk, take it away.
Going into the Neuralink architecture, what we've done over the past year is dramatically simplify the device. So we about a year ago, we had a device which had multiple parts, including a piece that it had to sort of sit behind your ear, and it was complex, and you wouldn't still look totally normal. You'd have a thing behind your ear. So We've simplified this to simply something that is about the size of a large coin, and it goes in your skull, replaces a piece of skull, and the wires then connect within a few centimeters or about an inch away from the device. And this is sort of what it looks like. Yeah. This is that little device. It is that thing at the bottom is just to hold the threads in place because they're just like little fine wires. I mean, frankly, to sort of simplify this, it's more complicated than this, but it's in a lot of ways, it's kind of like a Fitbit in your skull with tiny wires. And it's, our current prototype, version 0.9, has about 1,000 channels. So that's about 100 times better than the next best consumer device that's available. And it's a 23 millimeters by 8 millimeters. It actually fits quite nicely in your skull because your skull is about 10 millimeters thick. So it fits, it goes flush with your skull, it's invisible, and all you can see afterwards is this tiny scar. And if it's under your hair, you can't see it at all. In fact, I could have a Neuralink right now, and you wouldn't know. Maybe I do. In terms of getting a link, so that, you need to have the device, a great device, and you also need to have a great robot that puts in the electrodes and does the surgery. So you want the surgery to be as automated and as possible, and the only way you can achieve the level of precision that's needed is with an advanced robot. So we're really looking for great people who can help develop both the device and the robot. And we feel confident about getting the link procedure, the installation of a link, done in under an hour. So you can basically go in the morning and leave the hospital in the afternoon. And it can be done without general anesthesia. So in terms of getting a link, like I said, it's essentially you open a piece of skull, you remove about a coin-sized piece of skull, and then the robot inserts the electrodes. We'll talk more about that later. Then the device replaces the portion of skull that was removed, and we basically close that up with actually super glue, which is how a lot of wounds are closed, and then you can just walk around right afterwards. It's pretty cool.
So that's Elon Musk this week talking about his wonderful thing called the Neuralink. Well, the Neuralink, Martin was asking while we were listening to that, well, what's the point of this thing? So, Martin, the answer is, you'd have to ask Elon Musk, but what he's saying is that this will allow you to have a direct communication with a computer. So you will be able to think your way into the computer, and the computer will be able to think its way into your brain. The idea is linking up neurons in your brain with digital information. He's talking there about hundreds of little tiny wires from the bottom side of this coin-shaped thing that's going to go apparently into your skull, then linking up with a through Wi-Fi of some sort and through this device into a computer. This is one of the dreams of the transhumanists, actually, which is the idea of a human brain nervous system digital interface. This is what he's producing.
Yeah, well, I mean, Elon Musk the other day tweeted after the coup in Bolivia, somebody was saying that this is a coup, remove Morales. He said, we'll coup who we want to. That was his exact words. And of course, he was behind the coup in Bolivia because Bolivia's got very big supplies of lithium.
Ken Livingstone's actually lithium, just written an article.
Lithium is very important.
Calling it the lithium coup.
Yes, a lithium coup. And of course, Elon Musk was a major player in that. And there you go.
Speaking as an old science fiction fan, I think it's a great pity that, you know, science fiction has fallen down the memory hole to quite a large extent. Ian Banks was a great writer, if anybody out there wants to read any.
Fantastic stuff.
And, you know, but that's where it should stay, you know.
These are dystopias they're writing about. You know, this is the fact of the matter. It's almost like he's trying to sell this. This is a great marketing thing. Hey, this is going to be wonderful. Actually, the world he's describing here is definitely a dystopia.
He's another Richard Branson, isn't he, whose top skill is self-publicity.
Martin, would you like to have one of these things?
Well, I mean, no. I mean, I've just been reading Yuval, I think his name is, who's written these books about Homo sapiens and the Homo Futura. I can't remember the name of it now. But they're very popular, and lots of people have read them. And he sees the dangers of AI coming forward, and also genetic engineering. And that you know, they're trying to create superhumans. The elite are fantasizing about the idea that they can have super babies and things of this sort, and that this is now becoming a feasible fantasy for them to pursue. And of course, that doesn't, you know, they're not trying to solve problems that we need to solve. They're solving problems that they want to solve for their own purposes.
Yeah, it's a bit like the Colony on Mars crowd, isn't
it? Yes, exactly. I mean, we can't feed people, and we can't keep the bogs open in Bristol because we haven't got any money, but we're all going to be super chess players once we put this stuff in our brains, you know.
William Gibson is one of the authors I remember reading years ago who was talking about all this sort of thing, cyberpunk. But it was always, look, the people trying to do this are the bad guys. So he almost seems a bit shameless, Elon Musk.
Yeah. I think there's just, you know, some people are just a little bit deranged, and they can, you know, if they've got a good business head at the same time, then they can get
you old Luddite, you. Anyway. So we're going to wrap up tonight with a listen to David Livingstone, who just coincidentally is the author of this book, Transhumanism, The History of a Dangerous Idea. But here he is talking about another book that he wrote several years ago called The Dying God, about a medieval satanic group. What he says effectively is that they built the British Empire. A militant atheist establishment was created here in Britain, which led on to what we would call the New World Order of today. The New World, of course, being the United States.
The key central crucible, the key event that gives rise to the Rosicrucian movement, which is an alchemical hermetic movement. So this marriage, their marriage of King James's daughter and Frederick V, is called an alchemical wedding.
Hmm.
And what happens is that their grandchildren then become kings. I mean, what happens in between is that King James basically succeeds Elizabeth I, and she runs an occult ring, which is headed by John Dee, the sorcerer. John Dee and Francis Bacon are the two sources of the Rosicrucian teachings. She is succeeded by King James. King James is succeeded by Charles I. Charles I is executed by Oliver Cromwell, who basically succeeds to power for a short period. Cromwell was surrounded by Rosicrucian. His movement was a Rosicrucian movement. And they were in contact with the chief rabbi of Amsterdam. His name was Manasseh ben Israel. So all the leading Rosicrucians were in the circle of Manasseh ben Israel, and they were working together to petition Cromwell to allow the return of the Jews to England. Because the Jews, like in many countries of the world, had been forbidden access from England. They succeed. Oliver Cromwell allows the return of the Jews. So what happens is that the followers of Manasseh ben Israel in London, they establish the first synagogue in London called the Bevis Marks Synagogue. Hmm. And they become involved with the Rosicrucians. The Rosicrucians are also called the Invisible College. So the Invisible College developed the Royal Society.
Oh, the Royal Society of Science?
Right.
Oh, right.
So that's where we get all the people like Newton, of course.
Right.
Newton
right. Yeah.
was heavily interested in Rosicrucianism. So out of those circles, the Royal Society basically developed Freemasonry.
Talking about Freemasonry being developed by the Royal Society. Now, Martin, I know this isn't really your thing, is it? It's not the official version of history at all. But, I mean, he's a Muslim scholar. He's got a right to his point of view, hasn't he?
Yeah, and I've got the right to say that could be construed as an anti-Semitic conspiracy theory.
Would you throw him out of the party?
Fortunately, he's not. That's not an issue we have to deal with.
What do you make of these sorts of views of history? And it's a very, very, it's not what we're taught in school at all, is it?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind, I'm afraid I'm, you know, a bit sceptical, Tony. The first thing that comes to mind is that he's basically writing off, you know, some of the best scientists in the history of the human race, you know, as being pawns of something. Maybe they just thought it was unfair on the Jews that they weren't allowed to live here.
Well, I mean, one of his arguments is that even though people use the expression Jews, Christian, even Muslims, he's critical of the Muslims as well. He's saying there's actually occult organizations that are using these as fronts.
Yeah,
that's different. That's a different issue. That's, you know, but quite likely, you know, obviously you do get, to use a word we've touched on earlier, conspiracies to infiltrate things, you know, but you can't necessarily blame the body that houses these conspiracies because it may not be aware of them. And most conspiracies aren't very successful anyway, I don't suppose.
Okay, can you just wind up by reminding us about your little gig this week on the BBC? At the BBC, outside the BBC, Broadcasting House.
Friday the 11th of September, 3 o'clock or 4 o'clock. We're going to be there for a few hours. We've got some leaflets to give away. The BBC take them. You know, we got rid of loads. We ran out of leaflets last year. Although I wrote them myself, I'd like to say that they're good and unbiased.
Well, maybe they take them in as exchange for a free cup of coffee at the bar, and then they take them away and shred them
Well, the news department are the only snotty ones, and I do recognise a few faces that you see on TV, and they were quite hostile, but everybody else, because most people who work at that building are actually perfectly ordinary people. They're not sort of, you know, MI5 linked propagandists, which unfortunately some of the people on the news department are.
So I think we should be cheering for the sacking of all of the senior managers at the BBC, including the new director general, who, by the way, is a graduate of where? Anywhere interesting? No, PepsiCo. So the idea is we're going to have a massive, great Pepsi advert now.
Oh,
so
my goodness.
Going to be the BBC.
And Pepsi's the worse than Coke. Pepsi's the Republican one. Coke's the Democratic one.
God help.
I'm glad you've cleared that one up.
God help the BBC under this new director general. Anyway, time to sign off now. Thanks for our guest, to our guest in the first hour, this author of 9/11 Revealed, Ian Henshaw, also to Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Thanks also to our sturdy studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Download our MP3s and you can listen in the car anywhere you like. You'll find this show's podcast, story links, comment page, and our contact details, and the contact details of BCFM manager and board at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Have a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. Sunday evening, 6 p.m. Danny Lopsch and the Contemporary Christian Music Show. Fantastic listen. Do please join us for the Politics Show live stream at 5 o'clock next Friday. God bless. And don't let the banksters get you down.
Oh, We'll be right back.